Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago here. Until 5 a.m., I'm your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. You guys always program the music bumps that come back from commercials and news and all that stuff. Today is Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in at 312-981-7200. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. It is that time. It's the second. It's 2 weeks ago that we talked to Dan Feinberg, and he comes in for a biweekly visit where we talk about TV. He's the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And lots of TV to talk about. We always have a great time talking with Dan for his biweekly visit. And speaking of television, he also partook in an IndieWire.com discussion about the best anthology TV shows of all time. So we're going to get into that, the best anthology TV shows of all time. Also, lots of stars, actors, and actresses who went to extremes to transform themselves for certain roles and certain characters. Sometimes it was dangerous for their health, but some of the most extreme changes that stars went through to transform themselves for certain roles. The XFL is back. Did you guys miss it? Did you miss the XFL? Because they're back. The team names and logos have been announced. We're going to go through some of those and maybe talk about sports franchises that left different towns. So that's all coming up on the show. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us right now on Facebook. The Facebook page is updated during the show. It's interactive, and you can check out what's happening on the show on our Facebook page, which is why you should like it right now. Follow us now, Facebook.com/Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. And subscribe to our podcast. Every single second of every single show is podcast. And if you can't listen live between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., because I know some people are sleeping right now, you can listen at your leisure, bro, anytime you want. Just go to iTunes or any place where you get your podcast. Subscribe to the Nick D Show. It's free, of course, and you will get it delivered to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there we are. All right. Let's say hello to my my producer, the great producer there, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay, man. It's Dan Feinberg time.
Yeah. One of my favorite visits.
Oh, yeah. He's the best.
Gets me up to date on everything I need to know.
Yeah, he's great. He's been part of the show for many years now. He used to be with HitFix.com. That's when we first met Dan. Man, many years ago. He's been a regular on this show for many years, and I think he knows more about television than anybody I've ever basically had on the show.
He's an incredible writer as
He's
well.
He's a great writer and a really cool dude. So we'll talk with Dan Feinberg for our biweekly visit and talk about everything TV. So that's coming up. In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
Morning, sir. Doing well.
Good. Thursday morning?
Yeah. You know, the St. Louis Battlehawks is a little close to the Chicago Blackhawks, isn't it? Did you notice that?
Battlehawks? Are they
pretty close?
Are they? Is that an XFL team?
Yeah.
Oh, because I haven't looked at the article yet. I was saving it for the air.
Whoops.
The
St. Louis.
No, that's fine. That's fine. St. Louis Battlehawks.
I just saw it and thought, man, that's pretty close to the Blackhawks.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm doing. Yeah, the Cubs held on.
Wow.
That was close.
That was a close one. That was a crazy game.
I caught the ending.
For those who watched last night's Cub game, or were you were there, it was like 3.5 hours long, and it was not extra innings because there were, 23 runs were scored total. There's 23 runs on 28 hits combined. I mean...
Yeah, man.
I mean, it was an absolutely crazy game. But it was fun to watch. I mean, you know, every once in a while, it's nice to let those bats light up a little bit back and forth. And I'll tell you something, man. They're just a different team at home. You know what I mean? They really are. And I wish they could play every game at home.
I know.
Because they've been having rough go of it on the road, man. I mean, they need to pick that up, you know, because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the last six games of the season are away. So they've got a 6-game streak to end the season. They need to win on the road, but they play great at home. And boy, Chris Bryant, what a clutch home run in the eighth, man. That was such a big home run. And why was it Nicholas Castellano?
Mm-hmm.
That guy's amazing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he is.
Ever since we picked him up at the trade deadline, he's been on fire. He was, 4 for 4 last night?
Mm-hmm.
And he's... with 3 RBIs and, I mean, no. I mean, please.
Just about wherever the ball goes over the plate, he can hit it.
Exactly.
Wherever it's at.
He's a fun guy to watch, man. He is. And you know what? When Bryant hit that home run, he celebrated more than Bryant did. Like, if you watch the highlight, because he was on first. Castellano was on first when Bryant came up and hit that clutch bottom of the eighth home run to put the Cubs ahead and ultimately win. But if you watch the replay, it's really fun to watch him running those bases, because as soon as he goes out of the park, he goes nuts. He like does a jump, he flips, he's got the fist pump going. He seriously celebrated on that base path more than Bryant did. Chris Bryant was all business. KB was all business. But that was a fun game. It was a wild one. It really was a wild one, you know. And Wrigley, nobody left. You know what I mean? There were 38,000 people there at the beginning of the game. There were 38,000 people there 3.5 hours later at the end of the game. So
nice and sweaty, I'm sure. It was a soupy, humid night.
It was a humid night out there, yeah. What a difference it's going to be in 12 hours when they play again.
Yeah, it's going to feel like fall.
No humidity, mid-70s.
It's like heaven.
Yeah, except the bell won't sail out. That's one of the reasons why there were 7 home runs in the game.
Exactly.
There were 7 home runs in the game total. No, yeah, when it's hot and humid and the wind is blowing out at Wrigley, it's going to be a game like they had last night.
Well, I'm really excited because my mom and my stepdad just moved out to Colorado. So now anytime the Cubs go out to Colorado, I'm going to try to see a game out there because I know the balls are going to be flying.
They always do. There's no air there. They have no air. I don't know if you know that or not, but...
Should I bring like a breathing mask?
You should bring them because there's no oxygen at all. There's I don't know if you knew that or not.
People in spacesuits, man.
In Colorado, there's no air. So prepare yourself for that. But the balls go flying out when you go to the, what's the Rocky Stadium called? Rocky Village?
Is it Coors? Isn't it Coors?
It's Coors? Yeah, I think it's Coors. It's Coors
cool.
Field.
It looks cool. I've never been in it, but I've been around it.
Yeah.
And It's like plopped in the middle of a neighborhood similar to Wrigleyville. Nearly the same, but similar, because they're building up that neighborhood now around
it's
it.
Like,
it looks
like
pretty cool.
Fenway's like that too. Fenway's like right in the middle of the city, right in the middle of the neighborhood. So okay. Well, anyway, listen. We'll talk sports some other time. We might get into the goofy XFL teams coming up and reminisce about that fantastic XFL season from 19 years ago or whatever it was. But right now we got to take a break, and so Dan Feinberg can join us to talk about television.
TV party tonight! We're gonna have our TV party tonight! All right! We're gonna have our TV party, all right!
All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requested now, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. A little bit later on, we are going to be talking about the best anthology TV shows sports franchises that have left town, and how certain actors and actresses and stars completely changed themselves for certain roles, and how crazy that's gotten. So that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And there you go. That's what's happening on this Thursday morning. Right now, though, we want to welcome back to the show for his biweekly visit, Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And he talks with us about television every 2 weeks, and we want to welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How about you, Nick?
Not bad. Now, you had, was it 1 day left or 2 days left at the TCA the last time we spoke?
I feel like it might have been the penultimate evening. I feel like that might have been where we were at that point. Regardless, I appear to have survived. Or all evidence to the contrary.
well, what did anything? What were your takeaways again for maybe the last couple of days?
I feel like when we last talked, it would have been the eve or the morning of the NBC presentations, and basically the highlight there was a emotional Good Place final panel, and that was definitely the highlight of NBC's day. Though there were a couple okay shows with or okay panels rather with familiar stars, including Bradley Whitford and Jimmy Smith, so they're kind of going in on familiar faces to the NBC audience on a lot of their stuff. But really the panel talking about saying goodbye to The Good Place was the highlight of that last day, and kind of made that last day worthwhile. Yeah. It was emotional. Everybody cried. It was emotional. Kristen Bell cried. Ted Danson cried. Everybody cried.
I'm gonna miss that show. I really am. I really love that show. I think it's great, and I'm not happy that it's going.
I'm glad that they did not attempt to overstay or to keep the show going after some of the actors had left or after some of the key writers had left. I'm glad they let Mike Schur take the show to the place that he wanted to take it. And they are done with production. So that is a wrap on that show. So looking forward to seeing how things tie up.
Yeah. Well, I'm really going to miss it. So this Bradley Whitford show, is it Glee? I mean, it looks like Glee to me.
Well, it's a little bit Glee, but it also co-stars Anna Camp, so the first half of the questions were about Pitch Perfect, so there's a little bit of Glee, there's a little bit of that, there's a little Mr. Holland's Opus. I'm not really sure yet what the actual show is. The pilot is all I've seen, and I can't give sort of a positive or negative response to it, because the networks would prefer I not, but all I can say is it goes through a lot of plot in the first episode to get to kind of the premise of the show, and I'm not sure what the show is.
Okay.
So I definitely hope that okay. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just, as I asked the creator of the panel, somebody somewhere would have told her that the amount of stuff that they did in the first episode could have been a 13-episode first season. Instead, they got it all out of the way in 22 minutes, which is fine and well, and, you know, better than dilly-dallying, I suppose. But the question of what the actual series is, I am definitely hopeful that NBC is able to send more than just the pilot before that premieres, because based on the pilot, I'm not sure how it's really reviewable, but who knows? And if I have to review it off the pilot, I will find out how it's possible, but
okay.
My preference would be to see a couple more episodes.
All right. Now, what's going on with the new fall? How much of the new fall stuff have you seen?
I've seen probably more than half of the new shows, simply because there was just too much happening at the end of press tour for me to see everything, which would normally be my preference in these circumstances. I think probably, yeah, I've seen the general swath of them. I'm missing definitely a couple. There are a few things where either the pilots weren't ready or I didn't have time to see one, so I chose something else over it. I've seen enough to know that it's going to be another, let's just say, lackluster fall, but maybe one or two of them might have potential as they evolve. That's the best hope I have.
When can you actually talk about some of these?
As we get into September, get to a couple weeks before premieres, I will be hopefully seeing second and third episodes for a few of these shows and being able to actually develop, quote-unquote, opinions, thoughts. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing more of some of them because it would. It's always nice to be able to check things off my list that I don't need to watch any more of. So if things are going to get good, I'm always happy for them to get good. And if they're not, I'm always happy to cut bait.
Okay, all right, I got you. Have you seen? And I know you can't obviously really like review it, but have you seen Evil?
I have seen Evil, and it is interesting. That is definitely one where I would like to see a second and third episode because I'm actually curious to see a second and third episode.
Yeah,
so,
I'm really curious about it based upon just, you know, the nonstop advertising that CBS does for it while I watch, you know, Big Brother.
Definitely, they have put, I would say, more of, in the CBS reality that I watched this summer, they were putting more effort behind Evil and the Unicorn than other shows necessarily, but maybe Bob Hart's Abishola, for example, has been getting more advertising with other shows or with repeats. I don't know. But yeah, definitely those two were getting the most ads during Big Brother before I quit and during Love Island before I quit that. So lots of quitting. I'm a quitter, Nick.
All right. Well, let's get to get to some of the new stuff. I haven't watched it yet. I have the first episode on my DVR at home. I haven't watched it yet, but what do you think of The Righteous Gemstones on HBO?
I will be very interested to hear your perspective because you are more of a Danny McBride and his ethos and tone fan than I am.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, no, no. Actually,
oh, you're
not.
No, I think you were.
No, no, no. I'm quite the opposite. I can't stand Danny McBride.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah. No, no.
I remember you had an opinion on him.
Yeah,
and
no,
I
no. It's
the opinion was.
That's one of the reasons why I haven't watched it is because he's in it. I mean, I have it on the DVR because, and I'm interested. I think it's an interesting sounding show, and I like the surrounding actors who are in it with him. But no, that guy drives me nuts. Danny McBride.
Oh no, then if you are not. In my mind, I had you as a fan of Vice Principals and and Eastbound and Down. If you are not, you are probably not going to like this. And if you find yourself liking this, then you may want to find yourself going back and looking at those other shows because it's of a piece. It is. He has his tone. It is not my favorite thing, but there are a lot of things that I appreciate about it. So for people who haven't watched yet, the premise is basically that the Gemstones are a family of sort of Southern evangelists / megachurch proprietors, and various people in the family are played by the likes of Danny McBride and John Goodman and Adam Devine and a bunch of other recognizable people. If you stick around long enough, Walton Goggins, star of CBS's The Unicorn, pops up, I believe, in the third episode. And this being a Danny McBride show, Walton Goggins shows everything he's got to show because Danny McBride is a big fan of getting humorous value out of male full frontal nudity, which means that basically the world has kind of caught up with him because suddenly now if you're watching HBO, there's male full frontal nudity and everything.
Yeah.
So the world has caught up with Danny McBride. The thing I find interesting about his shows is that he always starts off in a very loud, kind of coarse place, and then he kind of backdoors in the humanity and strong performances and kind of finds a way to retreat into the more dramatic elements of the story he wants to tell. And I've seen 6 of the first 8 episodes of this season, and the 4th, 5th, and 6th are appreciably better than the first 3, and they're appreciably more dramatic than the first 3. And when the show begins to mine a little bit of drama, I find it more interesting. I think, for example, that John Goodman is excellent. I think that several of the more serious performances, Jennifer Nettles, who most people know as a country singer, is fantastic in, I think, the 5th episode, which is largely a flashback episode. She's really great. A lot of the actors are very good. They're all very committed. That's kind of a trademark of the Danny McBride show, is that everybody's on the same page and they're all yelling at the same volume for better or for worse. If you're not a fan though of what he does, this one will be tough. I don't know how it plays.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, Dan, hang on. Okay.
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter. He's a TV critic. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and we will get back to more TV talk right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline studio here, and 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on this Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday, get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. All right. Every 2 weeks, Dan Feinberg joins us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and we got TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. You know, before we get into more of the new stuff, I was very sad to see that tomorrow, or I should say tonight, is going to be the final episode of Baskets.
It is indeed, and I have seen it, and it is a good ending. It just is. They very clearly had awareness that either this season or next season was going to be the end, and they wanted to make sure that the story was going someplace with, I don't know, closure to the overall story that they've been telling and with emotionally satisfying beats, etc. And I don't think they could have probably found a better finale than it ultimately turns out to be. It's the show in more sincere mode, which is something that the show does extremely well, and entirely fair because the show has been really actually fairly hilarious for the past four or five episodes, I've thought. So it's, you know, the show reminded people of just how funny it could be in the home stretch, and then it ends on a sincere note.
Again, a great season. I love the show, and I really do love the way that Chip has changed over the course of the show itself, and obviously, you know, Louis Anderson, you know, goes without saying how great he is. But I always find it really hilarious to look at the synopsis of each episode on my menu, on my cable menu, because it's always like it's always just one dumb sentence like. One of them was Dale orders a cheeseburger at a Chinese restaurant. That was the whole synopsis of the episode was that. And the synopsis for tonight's episode, the finale, is Martha gets her cast removed. That's the whole synopsis for the episode.
But the thing is, and you know this and appreciate it, and anyone who actually watches the show knows and appreciates it, that's a very big deal.
Yeah, it is.
And so the fact that they're telling you that is pretty much, and the fact that they knew that they were having that in this season finale really feels to me like they pretty much knew it was the series finale. Yeah. Because and what an odd thing to feel like a series closing element is Martha has her cast removed.
Right.
But if you watch the show, yeah, you know that is a major portion of her character, and it is very well handled. That is all I will say about that. It is not treated as an insignificant thing. No, those episode descriptions are brilliant and entirely accurate because Dale did indeed order a hamburger at a Chinese food restaurant,
he did,
and it was wonderfully mortifying for all and sundry.
Right.
I've thought that this season has been just really strong. I thought that the Common Room Wake episode was brilliant and hilarious. I thought the episode with Christine going around town with her granddaughter and just talking about her family's roots, I thought that was just beautiful.
I did too.
And it's so strange and silly to think that in a silly comedy with a familiar male comic playing an older woman, that the role would be as well realized and written as it is, and just treated with as much seriousness and utter concern and empathy as that role has been really from the very beginning. It's remarkable, and that was one of my favorite Christine Baskets beats was the travel with her granddaughter and going through the family roots in Bakersfield and just talking about what it meant and what her roots were and what it meant for her to be Scotch Irish and in Bakersfield and from six generations of Bakersfieldians. I thought that was lovely. I thought the Sacramento episode was terrific. I've been thinking they've been closing really, really strong.
Yeah.
So just as well that it's ending. And down the road, people will discover this odd show and some of them will think it makes no sense whatsoever, and others of them will love it and wonder why they didn't listen to us, darn it.
Yeah, I got misty-eyed during a couple episodes just the past few weeks. You talk about this the episode where Christina's going with her granddaughter, and there's that really lovely moment where they're in the antique shop and she's looking at those pictures of the family photos, and she just kind of stops and says to the granddaughter, don't let these photos end up in a place like this. Don't let our photos end
beautiful.
Up in a place like this. It's just absolutely beautiful. Really, really beautiful stuff.
Yep. No, we've sung Louis Anderson's praises for this performance for basically 4 years now. So it's not like this is the first time regular listeners are hearing us talk about this, obviously. But every word we've said is accurate. This is just such a wonderful performance, and as we've said over and over again, it could have been a stunt. It could have felt like a stunt at any point. They could have winked about, ha ha ha, we know that you love Louis Anderson from his 80s comedy, and here he is playing a woman, ha ha ha, that's the joke. Not even for a second.
Right.
Did they wink at it?
Yep.
And that it's remarkable to me.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to miss the show. I'm sure, as you said, it has a very satisfactory closing. I'm just going to miss the weirdness and the comedy and the loveliness of the show. It's one of the more original pieces of broadcasting on TV, and I'm going to miss it. But
I agree, and I will miss our regular conversation about it. It has been a long time conversation.
It has. We've brought it up every time you're on. So Succession. Wow, huh? I mean, that kicked off pretty great, man. This show is so good. It's so good. Are people watching it?
People are definitely watching it more, and it has moved very quickly to a saturation point, I think, in sort of the media, intelligentsia, Twitterverse, whatever, which is to say that people in my Twitter sphere are at this point talking about it basically to the same degree that they talked about Game of Thrones for years. So I think that it is entirely disproportionate, the amount of conversation in my sphere to the amount of conversation about it in the regular world.
Yeah.
I think there is no question that it is a significantly more insular show than, again, Game of Thrones. But this was not a conversation people were having when the show premiered last summer, when, you know, my review was one of the most positive reviews when it came out, and people just weren't talking about it for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, and then suddenly people caught on at the end of the season. People are talking about it from the beginning of this season, and thankfully it's come out really, really strong.
Yeah, it has. And the acting on that show is just so stellar. Like, everybody is just at the top of their game, and it's brutally funny and just like, it's incredibly just watchable. Like, it's, you know, from the moment it starts to the moment it ends, you can't take your eyes off the screen. It is compelling and it's really funny, and I think one of the best shows on TV actually now.
I am right there with you. No, it is an amazing ensemble, and it's an amazing ensemble that's alive at every moment. So you watch a scene with 10 of those actors in a room, and you can basically stop paying attention to what's happening at the foreground at any point you want and just watch any character's reaction, just watch what the other people are doing in the room, watching how everybody is playing off of everybody the entire time. It is an amazing ensemble used as an ensemble, and I get such a kick out of it, and every episode has 4 or 5 lines of sort of just scathing dialogue that make me snort laugh, and I have to rewind it.
Yep.
It's Yeah, and you know, this week's episode with the stuff with the online media site.
Right.
If you, goodness gracious, half of the people I follow on Twitter felt like it was basically an episode about them, because at, you know, at this point, everyone I know has gone through some new media disintegration at some point in their career. Most of the people I know have gone through two or three.
Yeah,
and. But yeah, it just everything in the episode. And so that means it's an audience of people who, if anything is wrong, would have torn it to pieces. And everyone was basically watching the entire episode going, oh, my God, this is too true. Too true.
Yeah.
Stop it.
And absolutely.
It was.
Yeah. And if people aren't watching it, it's Succession. It's on Sunday nights on HBO, and it truly is an absolutely terrific show. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
There you go. Dan Feinberg is with us, Hollywood reporter. He writes about TV, and he joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More TV talk right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studios here in downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs that you requested now at 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about the best anthology TV shows of all time, sports franchises that have left town, and what actors and actresses have done to themselves to transform themselves for certain roles. A lot of actors go pretty far in that capacity. But we're getting back to our conversation with Dan Feinberg. Dan is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's get back to it. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
So just recently you did a review of The Terror Infamy on AMC. Tell us about that.
Indeed. First off, did you end up watching the first season or not?
I have not.
The first season is very, very good. It was based on the Dan Simmons book of the same name. And the title very specifically refers to an icebound ship in the Arctic in the 1840s. So while it was a horror series, The title had double meaning, and it was very close-ended, and so it was a question of how they were going to do additional seasons of it, and this plays into one of your conversation talking points later on the show. They announced right up the front that it was going to be an anthology series, and so the second season, which was created by Alexander Wu and Max Borenstein, basically takes the general trappings of the first season, basically people in containment dealing with the worst of humanity, but then also dealing with creepy supernatural stuff, and transposes it into the internment of American citizens of Japanese origin in the 1940s in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And so it's a thing where, let's be real, this is not a chapter in American history that has been over-chronicled on the screen. Like, you know, there are a couple stories. You know, there's Farewell to Manzanar and a couple other depictions of these Japanese internment camps.
Yeah, there was that Alan Parker film with...
That was Farewell to Manzanar.
Oh, right, okay, sorry, yeah.
Wasn't it, or was that the book and the Alan Parker movie with Dennis Quaid?
Right,
that's clearly not playing a Japanese student, Japanese citizen. Yeah, so maybe the book was the Farewell to Manzanar was a book. Anyway, hasn't been over chronicled. So on the basic level, without any supernatural stuff whatsoever, it's a fascinating story worth telling, and that's great. On that level, and then you get the creepy Japanese spirits and women breaking their bones in weird ways and becoming scary puppet things and killing people.
Oh,
and
man.
people being haunted for the sins of their past and other things of that ilk. So you can watch it on either of those two levels. I personally find it much more effective on the history level. than on the scary level. The first episode is creepy and disturbing, but then there are whole episodes that for the most part don't get into that at all. And so if you're, I don't know, if you're only there for the creepy crawly, it isn't as effective, but I think it's good stuff. And I watched, I guess, 5 or 6 episodes and was always and consistently captivated by something in it, just not necessarily always the same thing. The Alan Parker movie, incidentally, is Come See the Paradise.
That's what it is. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah. Not really Alan Parker's best movie, but still a story, again, that people aren't telling. And so, good on... Yeah, so Farewell to Manzanar book. This takes place in an internment camp in Oregon, and George Takei is both a supporting actor in it and also a consultant in it, because he spent some of his childhood in internment camps. And so there's a lot of authenticity to it. It's an impressive cast of largely Japanese-American, Japanese-Canadian actors, some of whom you've seen before in things, but some of whom you haven't. Very well cast, very well handled, and sometimes it's creepy, sometimes it's spooky and unnerving. I don't think it's as effective in that respect as the first season was. The first season is intense and disturbing, and it's a technical marvel, because the first season is almost all contained on these two ships stranded in the Arctic, which was all filmed on a soundstage, so there's really spectacular digital effects to make it happen at all. The sound design on that first season is so outrageously good, and naturally wasn't even nominated for an Emmy, which is so absurd to me. This season doesn't have those kind of technical standouts, but the production design is wonderful. The evocation of the camps is haunting, and you know, of course, it has the unavoidable ties that it has to our contemporary treatment of immigrants and refugees, and so it definitely hits home on that level as well. But I recommend it. It is not overly scary, but the first episode is, of the 6 I've seen, the most scary. So know that they lead with disturbing stuff.
Okay. All right. And that's the terror. I see here that C. Thomas Howell is in it.
Yes. There are obviously a couple representative Anglo characters, and C. Thomas Howell plays a not particularly nice, but also not snivelingly evil person in charge of one of the camps. Reed Diamond, very familiar character actor who you will have seen in dozens of things, is... a military person of some rank when one of the characters ends up trying to enlist. So there are a few, but for the most part, the cast is dominated by these Japanese-American actors who, for the most part, haven't been given this sort of starring vehicle on American TV at any point previously. And so, you know, is a big leap forward in that respect.
All right, great. That's The Terror Infamy on AMC. Hey, speaking of C. Thomas Howell, did you watch the Patrick Swayze documentary on Paramount?
I did not. How was it?
I thought it was very good. I happen to be a really big Patrick Swayze fan, and I thought they did a really thorough and nice job with it. And they had a lot of people that have worked with him as talking heads, and of course it was driven mostly by his widow. Who is, you know, obviously dominates most of the documentary in terms of talking heads and interviews. But C. Thomas Howell was one of the people that they interviewed for it, and I thought they did a really nice job, portraying Patrick Swayze as he was, and his ups and his downs and all that stuff. I thought it was very good.
How much did they say about his last TV series about Beast on A&E?
They talked quite a bit about it. I actually really liked that show a lot. And I had a friend who was actually in it, a couple of friends who were actually in it, because of course it was shot here. And I enjoyed that show. I thought it was really good. So they covered that really well. I could have done with a little more Point Break, quite frankly. but that's just me. So, and they do talk to Lori Petty, who I love, and Demi Moore. They cover Ghost really well, and of course Jennifer Grey. They cover Dirty Dancing. I think probably gets the biggest, you know, gets the biggest coverage in it. But I recommend it. If it's, I know that Paramount show it will probably show it 50 more times. So it's I think it's very good.
I assume it's hiding on demand somewhere.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Perhaps I will check it out.
Yeah.
No, I'm glad they honor Beast at least somewhat, because he was really, really good in
that.
He
was terrific.
And like, it was an entirely different performance, and it, to me, kind of gave the template or the blueprint for what his career would have evolved into.
Yeah.
And it was so promising, and it was such a reminder of what a compelling actor he was capable of being. And, and then it was obviously so sad.
Yeah. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, it's Dan Feinberg. We're going to take a break here for the news, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Dan TV right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Thursday morning. How you doing here till 5? Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about the best anthology TV shows of all time and how actors and actresses do extreme stuff to change themselves for certain roles. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. We are talking with Dan Feinberg, who joins us every other week to talk TV. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's get back to the conversation about TV. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
Very curious about On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is on Showtime, and it debuts this Sunday night.
Yes, premieres this Sunday night, and I believe that Showtime put the first two episodes up online early last weekend, I think.
Oh, okay.
But it might have only been a weekend tease, and then they're gone, because it does indeed premiere this weekend. On Becoming a God in Central Florida is a dark comedy, sometimes very funny, sometimes not funny at all. It was created by Robert Funke and Matt Lutsky, who between them have basically zero TV credits, which is interesting and not usual. And it's had a very odd development history. It was initially picked up at AMC, and at the time, Yorgos Lanthimos was going to be directing the pilot.
Whoa.
which to me that kind of lingers over the entire series, is the idea, what would he have done? And it is basically an unanswerable question, because he dropped out when it moved to YouTube Red, which then became YouTube Premium. So YouTube Red or YouTube Premium did an entire 10-episode season of the show and then decided they were going in a different programming direction, and it was kind of cut free, and Showtime ended up picking it up.
Wow.
And it would probably have been the best or second best, depending on your feelings on Cobra Kai, series that YouTube Premium had ever done, and I'm not really sure why they decided they didn't want to be in the business anymore. The series stars Kirsten Dunst as a woman who responds to her family's financial difficulties by becoming more and more deeply invested in a multi-level marketing scheme, a pyramid scheme called FAM, Founders American Merchandise. A pyramid scheme basically operated at least on the East Coast by a inspirational tape spewing figure played by Ted Levine, who is always interesting and here seems to be channeling Mark Twain, because he's got a fantastic mustache and he always has that great voice of his.
Yep.
So only two or three times did I think that he was going to tell someone to put the lotion in the basket. So I guess that's a plus or a minus. And anyway, so yeah, so this it's kind of this character's attempts to navigate her way through this pyramid scheme, while really all that she wants to do in the world is to start a jazzercise program at the water park that she works at. So she's got simple dreams that are forced to become a good deal more complicated because she's so embroiled in this thing. And so the cast also includes Mel Rodriguez, who some people will know from Last Man on Earth. Alexander Skarsgård appears in the first episode with a tremendous mullet. Keep an eye out, and Sharon Lawrence pops up, Julie Benz pops up, Mary Steenburgen pops up for an episode or two.
Okay.
It's a great cast. It really, mostly, though, is a showcase for Kirsten Dunst, who is wonderful. Mm. And I think the character can be seen as a companion character to her performance from the second season of Fargo, for which she was deservedly nominated for an Emmy. But it's not in any way similar. It's, you know, two women backed into difficult corners who have elaborate dreams that are more complicated than they're capable of achieving. So it is a wonderful performance, at times very, very funny, at times very serious and emotional. I like a lot of the supporting cast. Ted Levine is great. Bunches of people in the supporting ensemble. To me, it works best when it is being funny and outsized. Towards the end of the season, a couple things get more serious than I was really interested in having them become. So when it's good, I would say it's kind of Breaking Bad with a female protagonist and pyramid schemes instead of meth. when it's bad or when it's too serious, it's kind of Ozark with pyramid schemes. And so lots of people like Ozark, and so maybe that means that people will like it in either of its two conditions. I was just much more interested in the one where they kind of kept the sense of humor alive. But it is definitely interesting. I think Kirsten Dunst will definitely be an awards player, probably Golden Globes time. Showtime is usually very, very good at getting its actresses into Golden Globes conversations, and I would expect they will have a pretty easy time getting her into that field, because she is very, very good, and it's just a nice opportunity for her to do a lot of things that she hasn't always gotten the opportunity to do.
I'm a fan of hers. I've been a huge fan of hers all the way back to Interview with a Vampire. I've loved her ever since that, and it's nice to see that she's going to have this this showcase for her. So
I think it is a great opportunity for her, and more than a few times I've watched and thought, boy, I wonder what would have happened if Yorgos Lanthimos directed this, but it ended either. I mean, it could have been a horrible disaster. Who knows? He could have made everything worse and everything more quirky and precious and eccentric. And maybe that wouldn't have worked at all, but I still would have been interested in seeing it.
Okay. All right. I do want to mention that you and your colleague, Tim Goodman, had a little discussion about the pain and pleasure of summer TV. Can you sum up some of the things that you guys talked about in that? Because we're ending on the summer TV season is ending. So
it is indeed, and I think the best summary I have is, boy, there was still a lot of TV this summer, and boy, some of it was very good, and some of it was frustrating. We singled out a bunch of shows that we liked that people should be checking out, including a couple that we've talked about here, including Succession. We mentioned extensively Years and Years on HBO, which six episodes and just mostly really terrific. It has some bumpy spots, but I think in the balance, it's a pretty impressive series. We touched on a handful of other things, including Lodge 49, which you still need to watch.
I know. And I'm hearing it. And I hear it from David Pesquazi too. So I'm getting it on. I'm getting it from both ends. So
God, I mean, if your buddy who's so good in the show and has such a high profile role in it, I mean, you know, this is as big a role as he's had.
Yeah.
And he's this is like Succession. It's another show that is just an amazing ensemble, top to bottom. Everybody's great, and I really think you'd like it. And I really think you'll be disappointed if you don't watch it and it gets canceled after two seasons.
Okay.
And then you're like, oh man, why didn't I watch this?
So. I will. I promise you. But I promise you. You know what? By our next visit, I'll catch up on season one for sure.
Okay. That's ambitious, but yeah. I applaud the ambition.
Okay. All right. So as far as like some of the other summer TV, I know that your colleague Tim mentioned Perpetual Grace Limited, which I thought was just great. And I'm not just saying that because my future ex-wife Dana DiLorenzo was in it. I'm saying it because I thought it was one of the quirkiest and most original shows with some of the best acting. And it was just such a weird show. There was nothing else. The voice that Conrad has is just so unique and so crazy, and I hope it comes back for a second season. But I know that Tim did enjoy it.
Yes, Tim is a large fan of that one, just as he was a large fan of Patriot and Patriot, which will no longer be with us after two seasons. So certainly, folks are hopeful on this one, and maybe someday I will catch up on that one. I've been plowing through a variety of stuff. I'm trying to get caught up on The Deuce before the third season of that.
I gotta reacquaint myself. It's been a while. I want to go back and catch some of that again.
I assume that probably the third season will have a couple a year or two jump regardless.
Yeah.
So you'll get caught up as well as you can. But since I had, I think, ultimately only watched, I think, two episodes of the second season, trying to get through. I fell behind, but I wanted to make sure, because the third season will be the last, so I want to make sure I'm there. I've been trying to catch up on a bunch of stuff. There's entirely too much TV, Nick.
Yeah.
Entirely too much TV.
Yeah. All right, before we get out of here, it was announced that Dancing with the Stars is going to have Sean Spicer, and you tweeted a little bit about that. I don't understand the popularity of Dancing with the Stars. I have attempted to watch it once or twice. I watched the season when David Ross from the Cubs was on, only because he was on, and you know they just won the World Series, so I thought, okay, well, let's watch that. And I don't understand the appeal of that show at all. But Sean Spicer, huh?
It makes no sense to me because it's basically pandering to buzz. That is all it is. This is a show that has been on the shelf for a little while, and they wanted to make a splash, and so they made a splash by casting this repugnant man who did 182 days on his job and has never done anything else in his life, and his job in his 182 days was to lie, and to lie demonstrably for 182 days. That was all it was. None of your listeners out there, on the basis of 182 days of anything they do, would be deemed worthy of Dancing with the Stars. I certainly wouldn't. He achieved nothing.
Right.
He accomplished nothing. In 182 days, he told no truth whatsoever. He has shown no additional introspection subsequently. He brings nothing to the table other than let's watch a bumbling liar dance. It's embarrassing. He will not bring a single new viewer to that show, not one. So all that he accomplishes is to make us talk about how embarrassing it is that he's on the show.
There you go. Well, and I don't watch it anyway, so it's a...
me neither, exactly. It makes no difference.
Yeah.
I will not watch a second of this unless I am forced to by an editor, and I hope no editors of mine are listening to force me to watch it, because heaven help us all.
Okay. All right, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend. Lots of TV, and I promise when in 2 weeks I will be able to speak about Lodge 49. I promise that.
I am looking forward to that, Nick.
All right, Dan. All right, thank you, sir. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, buddy. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And check out his stuff on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. All right, let's break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate. No, in the in the Skyline studio here. If you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We're going to talk about some anthology TV shows. What are some of the best anthology TV shows? What are your favorites? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And Dan Feinberg, who joined us, is part of the conversation from IndieWire.com that they had with TV critics. So they had a whole bunch of critics pick their favorite anthology shows, and we would love to hear from you with your thoughts on that topic at 312-981-7200. It is Triple Play Thursday.
You made Triple Play Thursday.
It's one artist, three songs. What was that, and who picked it?
So that was Josie Dunn, a local singer-songwriter here in Chicago, requested by Squat. The song is called School for That.
Okay. All right, she's local. Good for her. All right. So, anthology TV shows. They're all over the place, and it obviously I guess the first one that would pop into people's heads, if you want to jump in, we want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200, would be Twilight Zone would probably be the first one, right?
Probably the king of the anthology show.
Yeah, Twilight Zone, which, you know, pops up a lot in the conversations with the critics. We want to hear from you guys. What are your favorites? 312-981-7200. Twilight Zone. Did you ever get into the Twilight Zone?
Yeah, I started getting into it when I was fairly young because they had like complete seasons of it at the video store, and I just thought it was cool. Like, I really liked the intro, the doo 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 doo, and I liked that they were little stories, and it really got me into the idea of short fiction that could still be really compelling and really interesting. And I was kind of disappointed with Jordan Peele's executive produced version.
I don't have the CBS All Access.
Yeah, there is some good stuff there, but, you know, it's one of those things where you can't really beat the original, so much so that they had to remake one of the episodes, the Terror at 20,000 Feet, or the one with William Shatner.
Which has been done, well, George Miller.
Yeah, he did his version of it.
He did his version of it in the Twilight Zone movie.
Yeah, and it's still a great story, but it's hard not to be like, yeah, I'd rather just go back and watch the Shatner one, because it feels so fresh, even though it's how many years old now? Like over like 50 years old?
Oh, more than that. Yeah, so what do you guys think? So yeah, Twilight Zone. I never really got into the Twilight Zone. I watched it, and I like it obviously. And you acknowledge what a classic television show that it was, and the impact that it made, you know, on pop culture and on television, and how great a writer and personality. Rod Serling was. But when I was a kid, I liked Night Gallery. And in retrospect, you look back at Night Gallery, and there were a lot of terrible episodes of Night Gallery.
A lot of duds.
But when I was a kid, that was the deal, man. You know, that was back in the early 70s. I watched that show when I was a kid, and I thought it was great because I was way into horror. And it was more horror-based than sci-fi-based or fantasy-based, like Twilight Zone, because Twilight Zone was more sci-fi fantasy, and Night Gallery was more horror-based. But I loved Night Gallery when I was a kid, man. I watched it all the time. And the one that I remember the most was with Sandra Locke and Norman. I can't remember the actor's name, but he takes her out on a date. And he gives her a brooch, and it's a brooch that it looks like a furry little like rodent, like a creepy looking rodent. And he puts the brooch on her blouse and takes the pin off, and he says it's like a magic brooch and it won't leave. And so as he's taking her home in the middle of the night, down an old British, you know, they're on an old road in Britain. He makes a move on her, and she doesn't like the advances, and he kicks her out of the car and makes her walk. And as she's walking through like this road or this area, the brooch starts to grow as it's on her chest, and it starts to grow and grow and grow until it's like the size of a large dog, and it's still stuck on her, and it looks like a giant rat. And so that's that. I always remembered that one because the brooch freaked me out. And as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, it basically swallowed Sandra Locke up. And then two drunk British guys leaving a pub are like, "Did you see that animal?" And it's like a giant, the brooch just, you know, it's a big rat looking giant brooch.
Yeah.
Crosses the road, and they're like, they slough it off because they're loaded.
Yeah.
And then they walk off into the dark.
So I
think it's called Taste for Blood.
Feast of Blood.
Feast of Blood. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got it right here. It was paired with Lindemann's Catch and the late Mr. Peddington.
Who was the actor? Who was in it? Because it was Sandra Locke was the female lead, and the guy I think it was Norman Lloyd. Played jerks, always played creepy, creepy dudes. But that's the one that stuck with me like forever. Like I mean, there were a lot of episodes of Night Gallery that I watched that I thought were really awesome when I was a kid. I've got the Night Gallery. I've got the book. I've had the author on years ago who wrote the complete guide to Night Gallery, and I have that at home on my bookshelf. But yeah, that was one of my favorite anthology shows. But that's what we're talking about, your favorite anthology shows. There are a lot of them on now. You know, Ryan Murphy is like the champion now of the anthology TV show. But there's a lot of them, and a lot of them are really good, and I like the different direction. I mean, we were talking about The Terror. Now the second season of The Terror Infamy, which Dan reviewed, that's an anthology show. That's an example of it, too. But there is a lot here. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. What were your favorite anthology shows? 312-981-7200. We'll get back to the conversation after the news, which is coming up after this.
Historians of anti-Semitism have long argued that anti-Semitism, it begins with the Jews, but it never ends with the Jews.
On September 9th, you can counter rising global anti-Semitism. Attend the annual What You Do Matters Chicago fundraiser benefiting the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. The September luncheon features anti-Semitism expert Deborah Lipstadt and honors former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Reserve your place at this important event on September 9th. Visit ushmm.org or call 847-433-8099.
All right, we'll get back to the conversation. What are your favorite TV anthology shows ever, current or past or whatever? Your favorite TV anthology shows, 312-981-7200. And did you like Night Gallery? hey, coming up at 6 a.m., Steve Cochran has your morning drive. It's 2:30 right now. Let's get into the newsroom with Vic Vaughn.
Nearly 500 people will lose their jobs in LaSalle County at the end of October. The Del Monte plant in Mendota is slated for closure. Its packaging plant. It's not the only location closing either. Del Monte Foods announcing closures in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Texas. Former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh is expected to announce his 2020 candidacy for president. He would become the second prominent Republican to challenge President Trump for the Republican nomination. Walsh is now the host of a conservative talk radio show. The New York Times reports he could officially launch that campaign as early as this weekend. Governor Pritzker has signed a bill into law that prohibits landlords in Illinois from disclosing or threatening to disclose a renter's immigration or citizenship status. He signed it yesterday at the Thompson Center in Chicago's Loop. Says it's aimed at protecting immigrants from landlords who try to intimidate or manipulate their renters. If a landlord violates it, the tenant can sue in civil court. Illinois now becomes the first state in the Midwest, just the second in the nation, to protect immigrant tenants. Sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
Hi, folks. Orion here again, and I'd like to invite you to stop in and meet my friends at Gary Lang Cadillac in McHenry during their end of summer event. Now, for years, I've trusted the associates at Gary Lang because they are the best in their class. Believe me, whether you're looking for the just-arrived all-new 2020 Cadillac XT6, sleek and sporty 2019 XT5, or the spacious 2019 Escalade, you'll find the right Cadillac at the right price right now with top-of-the-line service you can depend on. Gary Lang Cadillac is conveniently located on Route 31 between McHenry and Crystal Lake, or you can save even more time by purchasing your new Cadillac entirely online at GaryLangCadillac.com. That's right. You can purchase your Cadillac entirely online, GaryLangCadillac.com. And remember, if it doesn't say Gary Lang on the back, you probably paid too much.
WGN Radio conducts a variety of contests throughout the year.
You won!
Contests are void where prohibited by law. Prizes are non-transferable and can't be exchanged for cash.
No!
Winners are responsible for all taxes associated with prizes. WGN Radio may publicize or broadcast winner names or voices.
Yeah.
Winners are ineligible to win within 2 years of receiving prizes over $600 and 60 days for prizes valued less than $600.
I understand.
Employees and their families of
WGN Radio,
Tribune Company, and participating sponsors are disqualified.
What?
Go to WGNRadio.com/contest for complete disclaimers.
Okay.
WGN Sports, White Sox, took 2 out of 3 from the Twins in the Minnesota series. Shut them out 4-0 in the finale. Sox are back on the south side for a 4-game set against the Rangers tonight. It's game one, the pregame at 6:35, then the first pitch with Ed and DJ on 720 WGN. Back-to-back wins for the Cubs at Wrigley Field. They beat the Giants 12-11 last night. They'll go for the sweep this afternoon. First pitch at 1:20. WGN traffic, not seeing any issues on your expressways or tollways other than the usual overnight construction. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic Chicago app, approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. And the forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center, less humid and cooler over the next couple of days. Mostly sunny today, high of 78. Partly cloudy tonight with lows near 60, then Friday breezy, sunny, highs in the mid-70s. Right now it's overcast and 69 degrees at O'Hare. It's 72 at the lakefront. I'm Vic Vaughn in the WGN Radio newsroom, and these are the stories that matter on 720 WGN.
With every single kiss, the one thing rolling off my lips is la la ooh la la.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran has the morning drive at 6. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That's one artist, three songs, get your requests in now. 312-981-7200. For that. And we were talking about television with our buddy Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. And he participated in a Critics Roundtable discussion at IndieWire.com where he threw in his two cents on what are the best or your favorite anthology TV series of all time. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We were talking about Twilight Zone, and I was mentioning Night Gallery, which was the one that I got into really as a kid when it was on TV. I watched it. I loved it, and I loved the music, the opening music, and all that stuff. And again, that was Rod Serling, and it was more horror based than Twilight Zone, which was more sci-fi fantasy based. And there's some classic Twilight Zone episodes. The times when I would catch up on Twilight Zone is they would run a marathon on New Year's. And they would run a marathon on New Year's. Like I can't remember, a bunch of channels would do it. And that's on New Year's Eve. Also, in the years ago when I was a kid, and my parents would go out on New Year's Eve. You know, they'd go out partying on New Year's Eve, and then I would hang out at my. I would stay overnight at my friend Dan Long's house. Not Dan Long who works here, but the Dan Long I grew up going to school with as a kid. And one of my favorite traditions. This was a Channel 9 thing. On New Year's Eve, they would run Marx Brothers movies, basically like into the wee hours, and we would stay up and watch all the Marx Brothers movies. That was a New Year's Eve. I don't know if people remember that, but that was an absolute New Year's Eve tradition on Channel 9. Was you can put on Channel 9 on New Year's Eve and ring in the new year with the Marx Brothers.
Now I have to ring it in with Anderson Cooper and Kathy. What's her name?
Kathy. What's her name? Kathy Griffin.
Yeah, Kathy Griffin.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't. What's his name? Ryan Idiot, right?
Ryan Seacrest.
You about as Spanish as Rian Seacrest, with your fraggle ass rock hair. that would be from the substitute teacher sketch from Key and Peele, which of course is genius. But anyway. Yeah, so that's how we would spend New Year's watching the Marx Brothers. Yeah, man, that Duck Soup is a funny movie. I mean, really, it's ridiculous.
How late do you stay open?
It's just so funny. So funny. All right, 312-981-7200. We got a text here, 779 area code says, the Outer Limits. I used to love the Outer Limits, too. There were some scary Outer Limits ones. I remember there was like a dude turned into an ant or something. Like there was like a bug that had like a human face. I don't remember the plot of it. I just remember like the close-up of the ant like human face thing. It kind of, you know, it kind of like stuck in my brain. It was one of those images that was so... that was so creepy, and that was from an Outer Limits. But yeah, Outer Limits obviously was, you know, trying a lot to be like Twilight Zone. But I remember specifically some of the Outer Limits. Outer Limits to me, if I remember correctly, Outer Limits was scarier than Twilight Zone. They would go a little bit darker than Twilight Zone. But there are classic Twilight Zone episodes, obviously, that are, you know, we mentioned the one with Shatner on the plane. There's also Art Carney as the as the Santa Claus. That one gets shown on Christmas all the time.
My favorite is The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Yeah.
That's still so fascinating to watch.
Yeah. What was it with this episode of Seinfeld where they're like, it's just one where you think everybody's different, but you're the same, but you're the one who's different? That Twilight Zone episode, he goes, which one is that? He's like, oh, they're all like that. all right, here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Yeah, this is definitely one I watched when I was growing up. And actually, it was supposed to be the Creepshow series, but they changed it. And actually, the movie, the Tales from the Dark Side.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was a popular show. Very popular show, Tales from the Dark Side.
Yeah, especially the opening and the narration and all that. And, of course, I remember the movie. Of course, it was supposed to be a Creepshow series, but they changed it. And now they're actually doing a Creepshow series on streaming.
Yeah, that's what I heard about. I heard about that, too. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
All right, and we can get into anthology movies, too, because, you know, we mentioned Twilight Zone. The thing I remember when Twilight Zone, the movie, came out was the summer of 82. And at that time, John Landis was coming off of American Werewolf. And Spielberg had just come off, it was the same summer as E.T. So it was like he had E.T. in the theaters when that came out. So they were two of the hottest directors in the world. And nobody really, this was before Gremlins, and nobody really knew who George Miller was either, because that was the same summer as Road Warrior. And so nobody really knew who George Miller or Joe Dante were, and they ended up stealing the movie. Like, their shorts were so much better. Spielberg's was terrible. The Kick the Can one, where the old folks' home, everybody's changed into kids. Scatman Crothers was in it. Terrible. And the one that Landis directed, had such a horrible thing attached to it. It was the death of Vic Morrow. He had to cut the whole thing together, and it made no sense. And it was really bad too. But man, Dante's and George Miller's were unbelievable. I mean, they were the last two. It was smart the way they put the movie together, because they put Landis's first, then Spielberg. And then they were like, well, look, these two relatively unknown directors like kicked their asses with theirs, and so they put Dante's and they closed it with Miller's, which is perfect, because Lithgow is unbelievable in that. He's unbelievable.
He does a very good job with the material,
and man, it's just insane. I mean, it's George Miller. It's insane and so well directed. And the one that Dante did, where the kid could make the kid had all the superpowers and he could make anything happen, with Kathleen. Kathleen Quinlan was in it. Kevin McCarthy, of course, because Kevin McCarthy, until he passed away, was in everything that Joe Dante did. But yeah, so that was, and I just remember going, wow, those two guys really knocked it out of the park, and the other two established guys, not so much. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Favorite Twilight Zone was the seventh is Made of Ghost.
Yeah.
That's the one where they were on maneuvers and they kept going back to the battle of Custer's battle.
Right.
And they couldn't get the tank to the battlefield. But my favorite anthology show was Police Story.
Yeah,
it's on NBC.
Yeah, Police Story in the 70s. Big show. Police Story was a really popular show.
I think Police Woman was a spinoff of that.
Right.
And Dandy Don Meredith was on there four or five times, and he was funnier than hell.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Police Story was a good. That was a big hit too for NBC. That was on for a few years back in the 70s. That was a very popular show back then. And it was different every week. Anthology.
Okay. And they've never rerun it. I don't know why.
But yeah, it's true. That is one that you never see. That's very interesting. Yeah. You would think somebody. I wonder if it's out on DVD. We can ask Jeff Tuckman the next time he comes in. Next time. Okay,
and
Mike.
For Stupid Friday Nights, you've got Love American Style.
Oh, well, yeah. Love American Style was classic. And that's a lot of people don't remember that Happy Days was a spinoff of Love American Style.
Right. It was called Love in the Happy Days.
That's right.
Yeah,
Love in the Happy Days. Exactly. Okay, Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, Love American Style. Love American Style, truer than the red, white, and blue. Hoo-hoo-hoo.
I have to ask, like, why would they try to even use a similar title to Love Italian Style, which is a great film?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was right around the time when that movie came out that they started. But Love American Style was a wacky, anthology series. It was on right around the same time as Night Gallery. So you had your scary anthology series with Night Gallery, and then your love related comedy anthology series with Love American Style. Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that Happy Days is a spinoff, and we know that there were a lot of spinoffs from Happy Days, because there was Laverne and Shirley was a spinoff of Happy Days, Mork and Mindy was a spinoff of Happy Days, Joni Loves Chachi was a spinoff of Happy Days. I'm trying to remember if there were other ones, but a lot of people don't even realize that Happy Days was indeed a spinoff. It wasn't an original show. So, but there's a lot of them on the air now. You got American Horror Story.
That's a pretty. I never really got it. I don't think it's.
I watched the only time I've ever watched an entire season was the first season, and I didn't like it. I mean, I liked it for a little while, and then it kind of fell off track. But I stayed with it. I watched the entire season. I have not gotten through more than three episodes of subsequent seasons.
Meanwhile, have you watched the counterpart, American Crime Story?
I love American Crime Story.
That's what's weird to me, is that as horror fans, you and I should conceivably love American Horror Story.
Yeah, but it's not good.
It's not. it's so weird. Meanwhile, American Crime Story, the OJ season, the Gianni Versace season.
Gianni Versace season I didn't like as much as the OJ season.
No.
The OJ season was unbelievable.
It was.
It was unbelievable.
To me, it came out of nowhere. I was like, I can't believe this is as good as it is. What's
amazing is that also the year was OJ Made in America, which is one of the greatest documentaries ever made in the history of documentaries.
That was an ESPN.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a 60 for 60 or a 30 for 30, whatever they're called.
30 for 30.
But it's like 8 hours long.
God, I forgot how
it
much.
Is
that was such a big deal.
But seriously, one of the greatest documentaries I've ever seen in my life.
Absolutely.
All encompassing. I mean, it was a brilliant piece of work. But American Crime Story, the next one is Clinton.
Yeah.
Clinton and Lewinsky.
Yeah.
That whole thing.
That's exciting.
And what's her name?
Beanie Feldstein.
Yeah, Beanie Feldstein is going to play Monica Lewinsky.
Amazing. I mean, the casting across the board is insane, but Beanie Feldstein is Monica.
Yeah.
Is going to be something
well,
else.
Well, and also Monica Lewinsky's on board. She's one of the producers on it. And
which I think is the right thing.
Absolutely.
You have to do that.
Absolutely. I'm assuming you saw the interview that she did with John Oliver when John Oliver had her.
Brilliant.
Unbelievable.
I can't believe, because obviously that had all happened when I was literally an infant.
Yes.
So I really, all I had were the jokes and all that kind of stuff for my cultural understanding of who Monica
and
Lewinsky
is. She was the target of all of them.
She was the target of all of them. Yeah. And watching that interview between her and John Oliver, I was like, wow.
It was great. It was really, really great. I'll tell you what. One of my favorite things that Monica Lewinsky ever did, back when that scandal just ended, she appeared on the Tom Green Show. And this was when she was being hounded by paparazzi and followed by cameras and stuff. It was only a couple of years after the whole scandal had happened. So they did this whole bit where, like, they were pretending that they were a couple, and everybody was following them. And then basically what the whole thing was at the very end, it was that she was launching her handbag line. And they had tricked the entire, like, they had, like, the media there. They had everybody there to make this big announcement. And she had a great sense of humor about it. But Tom Green was freaking out because he had never experienced, you know, that kind of intense, absolutely insane paparazzi, you know, that could put your life in danger. They would do anything. I mean, look what happened to Princess Di. You know, these guys are nuts. They're dangerous, man. But yeah, that was a really brilliant thing that she did. And this was like literally, you know, like a year after the whole scandal had settled down. So, but anyway, so yeah, American Crime Story is better than American Horror Story by far.
Yeah. And I thought at the very least the Gianni Versace one was interesting because I did not know who this dude was.
The acting was great in it, though. And I mean, Darren Criss was unbelievable.
Yeah. Which is. I really liked him on Glee. I thought he was a very good actor.
You know how I feel on Glee. You know how I feel about
naturally.
Glee. I've said this a million times. I stayed with Glee long after everybody jumped ship.
Oh yeah,
I watched that show till the end. I'm not kidding. You know who was brilliant on that show besides everybody? Our buddy Stephen Tobolowsky.
He was great.
He was genius on that show. And you know what? His name was Ryerson in that show. And of course, you know the character that people most identify Steven with is Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day. So when he got the script, he told the story a million times, when he got the script and saw that the character's last name was Ryerson, he's like, well, I have to play this part. So, all right, let's break here. We'll come back. Anthology TV series. What are the best, the most memorable, maybe the worst or the weirdest? 312-981-7200. Right. Hey, what the hell? Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago here till 5. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Hey, we're talking anthology TV series. We'd love to hear from you. The phone lines and text lines are open. What are your favorites? What are the most memorable? 312-981-7200. Bakery guy says, Police Story is on overnights on Saturday and Sunday on Heroes and Icons.
Yeah.
What the hell is Heroes and Icons?
It's like one of those sub-channels usually owned by like CBS or something.
All right. I'll have to look for it if I have it on cable.
Yeah. And you know how there's like Antenna TV?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those style channels.
It's like that. Like there's this.
Yeah.
And
just movies.
Movies.
It's just called movies.
Yeah, those are the channels that Esmeralda watches all the time.
Yeah, because I don't have cable. I want to watch something, I just have the antenna. So I'm just like, oh, let's see what's on Heroes and Icons.
Okay, I'll look for that. Okay, Police Story, for everybody who was wondering if Police Story was still on. Dwayne from Elwood talking about anthology TV's Tales from the Dark Side with the Talking Fruit. I don't remember that. All right, how about some other ones here? Black Mirror, anthology show that's on right now, considered very popular. Some of the other ones we mentioned, for some reason, a lot of anthology series, for some reason, have a science fiction or a scary tone to them, because you've got Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Oh, my God.
Which
so
is
good.
Legendary and has so many great episodes and so many great guest stars, and you had Hitch introducing all of them,
and his introductions were hilarious.
They were.
He was such a cut up, really, at the end of the day.
He was a cut up, but he hated women.
Yeah, that's his big flaw.
That's a huge flaw. The way he treated Tippi Hedren
it's horrible.
On the set of The Birds is entirely unacceptable. But you know, it's one of the reasons, you know, it's because he's had these obsessions with his leading ladies constantly.
Like, yeah,
he was obsessed with Grace Kelly. And but that's one of the reasons why I think Vertigo's his best movie. It's the most personal movie he's ever made, too. Like, he reveals a lot about himself in that movie. A lot.
Very
and
much
so. One of the reasons why I think it's one of the greatest films ever made.
Probably top five.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How about Tales from the Crypt on HBO?
Yeah.
With the old Crypt Keeper? He would always do, like, scary. He's supposed to be scary, but he was always doing, like, puns.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
A little bit like a Freddy Krueger style thing.
Yeah. Freddy Krueger, that was Freddy's Nightmares.
Oh, yeah.
That was an anthology series, too.
You know, I did not even know that show existed until I watched the Nightmare on Elm Street documentary that's like 4 hours long called Never Sleep Again.
Yep.
And they do a whole section on the TV show. I'm like, man, I kind of wish I could find that. I'd like to watch
that. I think it's available on DVD.
Ah, probably. For the big
should have asked Robert a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Robert, you got any copies? I bet he keeps them in his
pocket. Yeah, he's got them in his pocket, yeah. But yeah, so the old Freddy's Nightmares, that was a fun show. And the Tales from the Crypt on HBO, there were so many, because they got some really great directors to work. Walter Hill did two of them. Zemeckis did two of them. I mean, you know, they had some other directors come in there and the two that Zemeckis directed, one of them was a classic from that they actually used in the movie Tales from the Crypt from the early 70s with Peter Cushing and Joan Collins. And that was the one with the psycho Santa, where the guy escapes from the mental institution. He's nuts and he's dressed up like Santa on Christmas Eve and terrorizes Joan Collins in the movie. And then and Zemeckis directed the one for HBO on Tales from the Crypt. It was really good. Yeah, but Walter Hill did one about a poker playing and Lance Henderson was in it. And it was where they're cutting their fingers off. They're betting and cutting their fingers off. I was talking to Lance about that a few years back, and he said it was one of his favorite things that he ever did. And he got to work with the great Walter Hill.
A dream come true.
Yeah, for anybody.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more here. What about True Detective?
True Detective, despite having one amazing season,
yeah,
one pretty good season, and then one just absolute trash season.
Yeah, the pretty good season was the Mahershala Ali one, and the terrible one was the Colin Farrell. Who was the other?
It was Colin Farrell and,
I can't remember.
Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn.
The guy who does our news, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, listen, let's break, and we want to get here from you guys. Talk or text 312-981-7200. Having some fun talking about some of the best anthology TV series of all time. And we'll continue that conversation after the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio. We're here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell. The great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. And it is Thursday.
Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday.
Get your requests in now at 312-981-7200. Okay. We are talking about anthology series. If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you for talk and text, 312-981-7200. So let's get back to it. TV anthology series. There's an article that we have linked up on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow, where IndieWire.com asked a bunch of TV writers to pick their favorite anthology series. Why don't I read to you what Dan said? Dan Feinberg, our good buddy Dan Feinberg, says this. He contributed to it, and we talked to Dan a little bit earlier, and he said, is there some trick answer that I'm missing here? Otherwise, it's going to be an entire poll of people just saying The Twilight Zone. Plus, Ben saying, I've cheated and looked at everyone's answers, so let me do something else. Is Leftovers an anthology series? I mean, I love Fargo, all three seasons, yes, even the third. But it's only worthy of being a bonus answer here. So the real answer has to be The Twilight Zone. Classic flavor, Rod Serling, you know the one. He mentions Fargo in that. And I love all three seasons of Fargo.
Same here.
I think they're great. And the last one, I just, the thing that I remember about the last one the most is David Thewlis's teeth. There were so many close-ups of that guy's teeth. And I was just like, and, Carrie Coon is so great. She's just fantastic. You know, Ewan McGregor in two roles. And what can you say about a Mary Elizabeth Winstead other than that she's awesome? So I like that. But I like all three seasons. All three seasons of Fargo were great. And I'm looking forward to the new ones being shot here.
Yeah. They were doing, I think they're going to be shooting it over at, I think it's called CineSpace or whatever. Yep. They've got that big place over there. Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting. If you're a Chicago actor, go for it, man.
Yeah.
Get on Fargo.
Well, there's a bunch of stuff being shot here, you know, all the time. I mean, when I was driving in here, lower on the lower Wacker part, there were like buses lined up all over the place and equipment everywhere. So they were probably shooting one of the Chicago.
Yeah.
One of the 900 Chicago shows.
Although they do make public transit a nightmare.
Yeah.
I take the bus home and they were shooting, I'm not kidding, on a residential street, and it was like threading the needle. It was really kind of precarious.
Yeah.
But we managed to make it.
But yeah, Fargo is a great example of that, of a great anthology series. We've got some texts here. 262 said, I enjoyed American Greed. 605, I liked The Veil with Boris Karloff and absolutely loved Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Currently, Black Mirror is pretty good. That's on Netflix. People can see it on Netflix. Michelle in Braidwood said, The Jar episode from Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I don't specifically remember that one. JB says there was an anthology series where they tried to retrieve cursed items. I can't remember the name of the series, but I thought the redhead who started it was really attractive. Okay. 815 area code says Masters of Horror. Yeah, I would love to see them bring that back. It was such a great, I mean, it was such a great idea, and it only lasted two seasons on Showtime. And they got, you know, most of the big names to get in there and direct episodes. I mean, they got Argento, they got Carpenter, you know, they got, they didn't get Romero.
No.
We got Toby Hooper. Yeah. I mean, all the Don Coscarelli, some of the, you know, a little too much Mick Garris for my liking.
Yeah. I'm not,
he's the one who put it all together though.
Yeah. You have to give him, you know, credit where credit is due, but I've only seen the first season.
Yeah.
Do you own the second season? Does that have a release?
It does. Yeah. I don't have the second season. I only have the first.
So, his contribution to it, Chocolate, was really strange.
Well, he directed, if I'm not mistaken, I think he directed four total in both seasons. But yeah, no, I thought Masters of Horror, you know, obviously like any anthology series that we're talking about, whether it's an anthology movie, some are going to be hit and miss. And that was kind of the case with Masters of Horror, but there were a lot of great ones. And
there were.
And particularly Carpenter's Cigarette Burns was, I thought, not only the best of the entire series of Masters of Horror, but one of the best things he's done.
It was great.
And I'm counting all of, I mean, including his movies, Cigarette Burns, that episode of Masters of Horror that he did was great. So that was really a lot of fun too, that, the Masters of Horror. And it was also, I love the fact that it was on, you know, a pay cable network, premium network, so that they didn't have to worry about censors. They didn't have to worry about, you know, things being cut out. And most of the Masters of Horror episodes would have been hard R if they were rated. So that was fun. How about Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, wow. I used to get really scared of watching that as a kid.
I think I'm trying to remember, Are You Afraid of the Dark, if that actually was something that freaked out Esmeralda, too. By the way, Esmeralda's going to be on the show tomorrow. She's coming in for a visit. She'll be in at 2, and she'll stay all the way till the end of the show. And for some reason, actually, Vic's going to be here this time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, the last, what,
Vic,
2 times?
Last 2 times Esmeralda was on, Vic was like, I'm not going to be here.
One, he was on vacation. The other one, he was sick.
Yeah.
Quote, unquote, sick.
He was just, like, avoiding Esmeralda.
And just for that texter texted in about the cursed item show, it was Friday the 13th, the series.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah. No real affiliation to the films at all, but Friday the 13th, the series was
okay. How about Goosebumps?
I used to get really scared. I'd turn off when the intro came on.
I never watched the show, but I did see the first movie. I didn't see the second one. I saw the first one with Jack Black. Well, Jack Black's in the second one, but he's only in it for like 2 seconds. And I actually thought the movie was actually pretty entertaining. I don't know how close it was in spirit to the TV show or whatever. But I actually thought, and the books, yeah, I mean, the books were huge. I actually thought the movie was pretty, I actually thought it was pretty entertaining.
Well, it had a, the 90s series was legitimately pretty scary. They definitely, I mean, it was all toned down to a certain extent. You know, it was good for, it was okay for kids, but it had a certain sense of humor, but it was way darker, a way more sinister sense of humor, whereas the Goosebumps movies are much more like pretty light, family-friendly affairs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't see, like I said, I didn't see the second one, but the, the first one was certainly family-friendly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's sort of the tone I expected when I went to go see Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I thought it was going to be, and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is pretty scary.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, when the kid's transforming into a scarecrow and there's hay shooting out of his mouth and his, I was like, what the hell is happening? And the creatures were creepy. That hospital scene in the basement of the hospital.
I gotta see if I can track you down a copy, because I think they, I don't know if they changed it back, but at one point they reprinted those books without the original illustrations.
Right.
Which was really disappointing, because those illustrations
were... Well, they freaked everybody out.
They were nightmare fuel.
Yeah.
So I'll see if I can track down a copy with the original illustrations, because you will love it.
Yeah. How about Amazing Stories? You guys remember Amazing Stories?
Yeah.
Spielberg was executive producer of that.
He's doing a new one for Apple TV.
Oh, that's right.
He's bringing it back.
He's bringing it back. That's right. There were some that were, you know, he got some pretty big time directors. I mean, he himself directed, I think, a couple episodes of Amazing Stories. I remember Kevin Reynolds directed a couple of episodes. Kevin Reynolds, the great director that nobody sees his movies. Nobody sees a Kevin Reynolds movies, and he's like, he consistently makes movies that I love, but nobody sees them. Like, one of my favorite movies featuring my favorite Samuel L. Jackson performance of all time was directed by Kevin Reynolds. It's 187, and, like, four people have seen that movie. Have you seen 187?
I have not seen 187.
Oh, man. It's unbelievably great. It is unbelievably great. And it's the best performance that Samuel L. Jackson has ever given. But, yeah, Kevin Reynolds directed a couple of amazing stories. They had a lot of directors. I have to look that one up to see who directed some of those. Why don't you look up Amazing Stories and see if you can, if they've got listings, because I think some pretty big-time directors. I think Dante directed one. And it was on in the 80s. It was on in a, I think it was on like in the mid to late 80s.
85.
Yeah. But it had some pretty good guest stars. You know, and every week, obviously, it was a different story, and Spielberg put his name on it. He created it.
So you've got, let's see here, Bob Balaban.
Bob Balaban, sure.
Burt Reynolds directed one.
Yep.
Bob Clark. Let's see, Norman Reynolds, Joe Dante, Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, Scorsese. I remember Scorsese did one.
Irvin Kershner and Timothy Hutton.
Yeah.
And then you get into Danny DeVito, Tom Holland did one, Mick Garris did one.
Of course he did.
Zemeckis, Brad Bird, probably very early Brad Bird, and Tobey Hooper.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of big names. A
lot of big names in the Amazing Stories world. How about, you know, Twilight Zone came back in the 80s. And William Friedkin directed one that was terrifying in the reboot from the 80s. Because Twilight Zone has been rebooted a few times. Like in the early 2000s, Forrest Whitaker was the host of Twilight Zone. But the one in the 80s, Friedkin directed an episode. And I want to say it was called Shell Shocked. It was about it took place in a diner. And it was terrifying. It was really, really scary. And I remember watching it and just being blown away by it. But yeah, so that, but it, Twilight Zone has been rebooted a few times.
It's called Nightcrawlers.
Nightcrawlers. What do they say about it? Does it say
so, for the plot, State Trooper Dennis Wells takes shelter from a downpour at a roadside diner.
No, it's much more than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, customers arrived during the storm. He describes a massacre that he's investigating that occurred at a local motel. The diner patrons witness a near collision between two cars on the road outside, and a Vietnam vet named Price enters the diner.
That's it. And it's terrifying. I remember, like, watching it going, because it was also pretty explicit, too, and really intense. And I remember watching, because it was on network TV.
Would it be on CBS?
Probably CBS, because yeah. I think...
they've got the rights.
Yeah. But I just remember watching it going, oh my God. I mean, just like being astounded by how really intense and scary it was. And when I interviewed Friedkin, I brought it up. And he said he was given like complete freedom to direct it and everything. So, all right, let's take a break here. And we got more Anthology TV to talk about here. If you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Anthology TV talk continues after this. Ah, yes. We didn't, I didn't ask who requested the Bowie, did I?
No, it's coming to us from Greg H.
Greg H. wanted to hear some Bowie on Triple Play Thursday. You be Triple Play Thursday! All righty then. All right, we're back, and we're talking about TV anthology shows. And 708 area code said, Twilight Zone episode that got me as a child was where the man had a watch that would freeze time when it stopped, and then he broke the watch and the world froze indefinitely. I never forgot to wind my Mickey watch again. It freaked me out. Yeah, that's a classic one. 301 area code says, Dr. Terror's House of Terror and Dead of Night are two great anthology horror movies. There were a bunch of really fun ones in the late 60s, early 70s that came out of Hammer and Amicus. There were some British horror films that were anthology ones. The best being Tales from the Crypt, the original Tales from the Crypt with Ian Richardson and Joan Collins and the great Peter Cushing. That one's always been my favorite Peter Cushing performance. Besides, him owning Van Helsing, you know. But he's heartbreaking in Tales from the Crypt. Mr. Grimsdyke, he's the old guy, and the jerk who lives across the street wants him out of the neighborhood, and so he does all these terrible things to him, and then he hangs himself. He ends up hanging himself. Peter Cushing ends up hanging himself. He's an old man who's just really sad because his wife has passed away. So he lives by himself, and he talks to a picture of his wife and stuff. And, like, he tries to, you know, he has a bunch of dogs that he looks after, and he entertains the kids in the neighborhood. But then that all stops because of the jerk who lives across the street. And I always remember the jerk who lives across the street. I don't know the actor's name, but he always reminds me of Billy Joel. Not Billy Joel now, not Dean Richards Billy Joel, but young Billy Joel with hair, like, you know, that period of Billy Joel. But so then he hangs himself, Peter Cushing hangs himself, and then he comes back from the grave as zombie Peter Cushing and kills Billy Joel and tears his heart out. But yeah, no, that's a really, really great anthology series. I think pretty much every story, there's not a clinker in that one. You know, and as we're talking about, you know, these anthology TV shows and even the anthology movies, there's always going to be one or two that are like, eh. But that's, I don't think that was the case with the original film version from 1971 or 72 of Tales from the Crypt, which is just great stuff. How about The Hitchhiker? That was on USA and it was on HBO, and then I think it moved to USA. You remember The Hitchhiker?
The Hitchhiker.
It was an anthology series. It started out on HBO, and then I think it moved to USA.
Do you remember what year that was?
Late 80s? Mid 80s? It was definitely the 80s. The Hitchhiker. It was one of those, you know, because it was one of the first, if I remember correctly, because we got HBO in 85. We got cable in 1985. It was the first time we got cable. And it was on there, and I thought it was, we thought it was really cool because it was original programming on HBO, and it could be, like, adult.
Ooh.
That's why Dream On was such a big show when it first started, because you got to see boobs on TV with Brian Benben, who's married to Madeline Stowe.
Jeez.
Yeah, but his big break for Brian Benben was Dream On,
yeah,
which is a terrible show. But we thought it was, I thought it was great because it was like, ooh, look, it's an HBO TV show, but you can have boobs and swear. And we thought that was cool.
You could say things like damn and hell.
Even more than that. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
I remember The Hitchhiker, Nick.
Yeah.
It was a good program.
I don't remember whether it was good or not. I just remember that it existed.
Yeah, I was telling Tom that and the original Tales for the Crypt, I remember the episode where the guy came back to life, but he had embalming fluid in him.
Yeah.
Kind of messed them all up, and I think he cracked or something.
Well, no, what they did was, because that was the monkeys, the Curse of the Monkey's Paw. It's a classic old one. If they wish on something, it comes true. And okay. He was embalmed. He comes back to life because they wish for him to come back to life. He comes back to life. He's been embalmed, and she tries to kill him by chopping him up with a sword. But all the pieces of his body keep moving, like they chop it up, and all the the pieces of his body keep moving. Yeah, that's. I remember. I saw Tales from the Crypt. I've seen that movie like 900 times. One of my favorites as a kid.
Saw it was on Svengoolie back in probably 1970-71.
Well, it came out in 71, so that was when it was in theaters. So, I mean, it would have probably been the 80s if you saw it on Svengoolie.
No, the original Svengoolie. On the screaming yellow...
With Jerry G. Bishop?
Yeah, now, Svengoolie, what was it called? Screaming Yelling Theater?
Yeah, Screaming Yellow Theater with Jerry G. Bishop as Svengoolie. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but the movie came out in 1971 or 72, Mike, so I don't think it would have been on TV the same year it came out.
Okay, maybe a little later than that, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah. Okay, all right, Mike, thanks, man.
Hey, how'd you like the gong yesterday?
The gong, well, it got me to talk about George Jefferson, so.
Yeah, I know, I liked, that was a good story.
That's him, that's the man, yeah.
You know, David Allen passed away like 4 years ago.
Right, I know, yeah.
But Steve Hillage, he also played with Gong.
Okay. All right, Mike. Thanks, man.
All right. Take care.
There you go. There's Mike, the leading contender for Gong, president of the fan club, Gong fan club.
They're still releasing albums, you know.
Even after David Allen died?
Yeah, I think they had one either last year or earlier this year.
Oh, all right. All right. Well, look. So, Anthology TV, you want to check out the article that we've got? It's on our Facebook page. So it's facebook.com/NickDShow. All right, we're going to break here. We got the news coming up, and then stars who went to extreme measures to transform themselves into a character or a role. Some of these things are absolutely nuts. You know how far some actors will go to be method, and we're going to talk all about that. 312-981-7200. If you have any contributions to that. And we will return with the news after this. Blue Jim, I just made a girl named Blue Jim. Blue Jim, she got a camouflage face in her mind. Remember, they always let you down when you need them. Oh, Blue Jim, is heaven really sweeter than now. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive. How's it going, everybody? All right, so, you know, people are, some actors are very method. You know, they do the whole... call me by my character's name, I won't answer to my real name stuff. And some actors do that, some actresses do that as well. And then some go so far as to completely sort of transform themselves and their bodies for roles. And it's always been kind of a strange thing. And we have some of the most incredible examples of people of actors and actresses who went through sort of extreme changes and extreme measures to get into a character. And so that's what we're talking about here. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for extreme cases of actors and actresses doing crazy stuff in order to transform into a character. So if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Tom, you all right?
Just got a great text in.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I just see Tom in there laughing. I thought maybe he was just losing his mind for some reason.
I mean, that's also happening, but, you know.
Okay. So, you know, people spend a lot of time, like they'll spend months losing or gaining weight or doing all kinds of crazy stuff to get into a role. So here are some examples, and we want to hear from you. What movies do you remember? What actors and actresses do you remember who did, like, some really, really crazy stuff in order to transform into a character for a movie? Like, for instance, Natalie Portman in Black Swan. Natalie Portman got an Oscar for her role in Black Swan, which, by the way, she totally deserved. And I love that movie. I think Black Swan is just a fantastic movie. And she deserved it. After a grueling schedule of 16-hour days, little sleep, and a punishing diet of carrots and almonds, Natalie dropped 20 pounds for the role. Well, she did play a perfectionist ballerina, so she immersed herself in the world of ballet for an entire year. Still, she later said that she got so wrapped up in the role that it left her physically and emotionally drained. In the movie, Natalie competes for the lead role of a prima donna ballerina in a production of Swan Lake. She took it so seriously that she even broke a rib but continued as dancers do incredible stuff and hide the pain. Her determination really was a case of life imitating art. To add to her portrayal, she also spent hours in makeup, the white representing her innocence and grace, and the dark wing eye makeup, a symbolic of her competitive side. You know, Natalie Portman only weighs about 90 pounds anyway, and so she lost a bunch of weight in this case, broke a rib. But she did end up meeting her husband. She did know she met her husband on the set, who was one of the choreographers and one of the dancers. So she met him, but yeah, she won the Oscar, and it was not pleasant. And I love that movie. I mean, I absolutely think that movie is just genius, and really creepy and really scary and very, of course, Darren Aronofsky. All right, let's see. 301 area code sends a text. Probably no actor put himself through so much painful makeups to play a role as silent film star Lon Chaney Sr. Yes, he did. He absolutely did. 804 Erico said, I just watched Nicole Kidman in Destroyer. What a great performance. Yeah, she's great in it. Movie's not that great, but she's great. And really de-glammed and wore a whole bunch of stuff, you know. Brian brings up Jim Cotta. The deftly talented superstar Kurt Thomas probably did not have to do much to prep for his terrific chalked-up role as Jonathan Cabot in the greatest movie of all time, Jim Cotta. Nick likely recalls the tagline, the skill of gymnastics, the kill of karate. Is this your first encounter with Jim Cotta, Brian? No, it's not.
No, it just makes me laugh every time.
Yeah.
It's.
Anytime we bring up anything movie related, for some reason, Brian brings it all back to Jim Cotta. So, but yeah, Kurt Thomas. All right, let's see. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
Good.
Yeah, I'm mentioning this because it involves a trailer that just dropped. It was the teaser, Charlize Theron in Monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, she really nailed it in that performance. She deserved that Oscar because she really did a good transformation on that. She really looked the part. The reason I'm mentioning it because there's a trailer that just dropped today featuring her, Nicole Kidman, and Margot Robbie. It was a movie called Bombshell.
Right.
And she's playing Megyn Kelly. And she looks so unrecognizable. She looks just exactly like her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they did a bunch of makeup on them to make them look like their counterparts that they're actually playing. So, yeah.
I see. I smell another Oscar, man.
Yeah, well, we'll see. All right, Ike. Thanks, man.
No problem.
Okay. Not a fan of Monster at all. and I don't like her in it. I think, and I've said this before, I think it's the worst performance to ever win a Best Actress award. I've said it before. And you know, I was not a Charlize Theron fan until basically Furiosa was the movie that that won me over. And then since then I've been a fan of hers because I loved Young Adult. I thought Young Adult was great. I loved, oh man, was it Tully?
Yeah, that was from Jason Reitman.
Yeah, both of those. Yeah. And I thought she was fun in Atomic Blonde. But it wasn't really until Furiosa that I was a fan of hers. I thought Monster was a terrible movie. I thought it was terrible, and I thought she was terrible in it. And I was just like, okay, so she gained some weight, and she didn't wear makeup, and she wins an Oscar. So, was not a fan. And I know I'm in the minority on that. People love that movie, and they loved her in it. But I seriously did not become a fan of until Fury Road.
That's... I'm honestly gobsmacked.
Really?
Yeah, because I love Monster. I think it's an amazing movie. Yeah. But, you know...
Did not do it for me.
That's fair enough. I mean, it's the same thing with me, you and I, and Silence of the Lambs. I know you really, really hate Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, I hate that movie.
And I hear you. I don't want you to think that I don't take your criticism seriously, but... Eh.
Yeah, no, I'm morally offended by that movie, by Silence of the Lambs. And I'll tell you, I think Anthony Hopkins is fine in it, and Jodie Foster's great in it. I will fully admit that her performance is great. It's a performance that's in a reprehensible movie. All right, here's Doc on WGNA. Doc.
Hey, another great topic.
All right.
Hey, for weight loss, it's hard to beat Christian Bale and the Machinist.
My God, man.
That was dangerous.
It's scary, man. It's terrifying.
I think he got down to 127.
He looks terrifying in that. And it's insane that he did that. And then American Hustle, he gained a bunch of weight for that. He gained a bunch of weight to play Dick Cheney in Vice, although there was also makeup involved in that. He's one of those guys. He is one of those method dudes. And
the one where Mark Wahlberg played the boxer, I can't remember the title.
Yeah, the fighter.
Yeah.
Yeah. At Dickie the end Edlin. Of the movie, they're showing off the actual people.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, he's a ringer for that dude.
he won for that, didn't he? Win Best Supporting Actor for that?
He did. Yeah.
Yeah. He was great. He was great, and so did Melissa Leo. She won Supporting Actress in that.
If only Mark Wahlberg could have stood up and been also good in that movie.
He was good.
He was not.
Oh, man. You just don't like Mark Wahlberg.
I mean, maybe. That might be it. But I love Boogie Nights. I love Boogie Nights. He's amazing in Boogie Nights.
He's great in that. He's been good in a few movies. He's great in The Departed. He's phenomenal in The Departed.
Agreed.
All right, Doc. Thanks, man.
All right.
Take care. Yeah, The Machinist. Oof.
I remember as a kid, when was that, 2004?
Early mid-2000s.
Because yeah. I used to come home every day from school and watch Extra. I was so
upset. Extra! Extra!
Before Mark McGrath was on it.
Yeah.
But I remember watching a report where they're just like, shocking weight loss from Christian Bale. And I didn't know who Christian Bale was yet. I hadn't seen Batman Begins. And I just remember seeing the photo of him in The Machinist and being like, wow, a guy really did that to be in a movie.
Yeah, no, it's insane. That's one of the most extreme examples of it's got to be mentioned in this article. You can't write an article about actors and actresses who go to extreme measures to transform themselves and not mention The Machinist.
He's got to stop this, though. He really does.
Yeah.
He's getting up there in years. It's going to really start getting hard and dangerous. Yeah.
But Christian Bale, man, he's one of the best, and he's always been one of the best. I mean, listen, man, as a kid, his performance in Empire of the Sun is unbelievable.
Awesome.
It's one of the best child performances I've ever seen, ever.
I will say, I watched Public Enemies last night, and it reminded me that it's not his greatest turn. That's the one movie where I'm just like, he's okay. He does his job.
Well,
he's Melvin Purvis.
But everything in that movie is a little underwhelming, except for my friend Mike View, who screws up the jailbreak scene and gets thrown out of the car. That's my buddy Mike View.
I think Billy Crudup as Hoover's.
I don't even.
Good.
I got to tell you, I don't even remember that movie. I remember.
I remember.
I seriously remember nothing except my friend Mike's in it. That's the only thing that I remember about that movie. Truly. So, all right, let's take a break here. And we are talking about all these crazy things that actors and actresses do to transform themselves for a part. And we just mentioned, Doc mentioned, one of the most extreme examples was all the weight loss that Christian Bale did for The Machinist. And we'll get into more of that. A lot of these are really crazy. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200.
She wore blue. Was the night softer than satin was light.
You want to come with Raymond? Come on with Raymond. Welcome back, everybody. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, baby, Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. We're going to get back into the conversation about actors and actresses who completely transformed themselves for roles. We're going to hear three Bobby Vinton songs?
You betcha.
Wow. All right. Who requested that?
It's coming to us from Glenn.
Glenn. All right.
Triple Play Bobby Vinton.
All right. There you go. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. 312-981-7200 for actors and actresses who did crazy stuff to transform into characters for movies. And here's Peter on WGN. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
All right.
I was thinking about Fred Gwynne with the Munsters and Heath Ledger for the Joker.
Yeah, Heath Ledger for the Joker. Well, Heath Ledger was another one of those guys who was very method. Fred Gwynne, that was they put a lot of makeup on Fred Gwynne as Herman Munster. So
2 or 3 hours worth, I heard.
Yeah. A lot of those early days when they had to do the makeup. You had to sit in those chairs, get there at like 4 o'clock in the morning in order to be ready by 8. So that's some crazy stuff. All right, Peter, thanks for the call.
Have a good day.
All right. Fred Gwynne, by the way, national treasure.
Sometimes dead is better.
He was a national treasure. He was great, and he's best thing in Pet Sematary. Fred, I mean, he's Herman Munster. For God's sake, he's Herman Munster. Every time Herman Munster has like a spaz and jumps up and down and ceiling tiles start falling on him, I laugh every single time. but also, I mean, what can you say about My Cousin Vinny? That was one of those movies. You know how when you're not expecting anything from a movie, or you're expecting a terrible movie, and then you're completely shocked by it? My Cousin Vinny was that for me. And we were talking about this off the air yesterday, the other morning, Tom, because you were watching BBC America, and they were showing Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Or is that... Rise is the first one, right?
Rise is the first
one. I was getting confused. Rise, Dawn, War, right? Okay. And Dawn being the best of the three.
Dawn is definitely the best.
But I went into that movie going, okay, well, this is going to suck. You know, here's another Planet of the Apes movie. They're going to try and reboot the Planet of the Apes movies after the insanely awful Tim Burton version of Planet of the Apes with Mark Wahlberg. Terrible. Just terrible. And I remember going into the theater to see Rise of the Planet of the Apes, just thinking it was going to be the worst thing ever, and just being blown away by it. Could not believe how good it was. You know, it came out in August. You know, and that's a lot of the dumping grounds for bad movies is this month that we're talking about. Came out in August, came out a few years after the Tim Burton version, and then it was amazing. I felt the same thing about My Cousin Vinny. I expected it to be absolutely terrible, and it's one of my favorite comedies. And for people who say that, like, you know, there's all these people who were like, well, that must have been a mistake. Marissa Tomei won the Oscar for it. You know, and a lot of people are like, she doesn't deserve the Oscar for it. Yes, she does. She's great in that movie. And, you know, and I've talked about this a million times about how the Academy, you know, points their nose up at comedies, Like, the very, very rarely does a comedic performance get nominated or win. Or do comedies get nominated for Best Picture? It doesn't happen very often because it's all got to be ultra serious. The first, you know, like, I think she was the first Oscar winner, comedy Oscar winner, since Kevin Kline. Because Kevin Kline won for Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, and that was, what, 88? Yeah.
And in both cases, they deserved it.
Oh, totally.
Kevin Kline is hilarious in A Fish Called Wanda. He is hilarious in it. And Marisa Tomei is just spectacular in My Cousin Vinny.
We didn't lose Vietnam. It was a tie.
Yeah. But I'll tell you something. Again, My Cousin Vinny, just such a beautiful movie. And it does not, and I thought it was just going to be fish out of water, New York guy making fun of Southern stereotypes. That's not at all what it's about. Every person in that movie is three-dimensional and intelligent. And it wasn't, I thought it was going to be like exploiting the South. Oh, look at the New Yorker goes to the South and the Southerners are idiots and he's a New Yorker and he's going to be, and that's not at all what it is. Not at all. And everybody's so good in that movie. And that's one of those movies that, like Midnight Run, it's a remote dropper for me. Like whenever My Cousin Vinny is on TV, I will watch it. I don't care where it is. But my biggest remote dropper, without question, is Midnight Run. I could watch that movie. If there was a 24-hour Midnight Run channel, I would watch it.
Now, Nick, I always think of this whenever I hear My Cousin Vinny. As a man of Italian descent, yeah. Do you have a Cousin Vinny?
Oh, yeah. No. I do not. No, do I have a Cousin Vinny? I thought you were going to ask me if I had people like that in my family.
Oh, I mean.
Yeah.
I got an Uncle Vince. It's like an Uncle Cousin Vinny.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah. So, but hey, Nick, great show. Was it De Niro lost 40 pounds for Raging Bull and he gained it back running and eating brown rice? That's how he lost the weight. Well, he gained and lost a lot of weight for that. He gained a ton of weight for Raging Bull.
Because he had to be fighting weight and then he has to get heavy for the last
Then he had
half.
To be fat LaMotta. He had to be fat stand-up comedian LaMotta.
Yeah.
So.
Great movie, though. Great picture.
Yeah, yeah. Lost to Ordinary People.
God.
Martin Scorsese lost to Robert Redford that year for Best Director. Oh, and then in 1990, Goodfellas lost to Dances with Wolves. And Scorsese again lost to an actor making his directorial debut, Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner won Best Director instead of Martin Scorsese for Goodfellas. Now, see, here's the thing, though. I will say this. I love Ordinary People.
It's a great movie.
I love it. And I do not love Dances with Wolves at all. So, anyway. He finally got his Oscar, but he got it for The Departed.
I'm not a cop.
It's a good movie. It's not one of his best, but it's good. Man, The Irishman, I can't wait to see it.
It looks
nice. Oh my God, please. All right. We got a break here for the news when we come back. More insane transformations from actors and actresses in movies.
I have nobody for my own. I'm so lonely. I'm Mr. Lonely. Wish I had someone to call on the phone.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. You've been Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. And we are talking about some of the extreme measures that actors and actresses went through in order to transform themselves into different roles. And we were talking about how the insane weight loss that Christian Bale did for The Machinist, the crazy being sleep deprived and losing a bunch of weight for Black Swan, Johnny Depp in Black Mass. Just when you thought Johnny Depp would be a pirate of the Caribbean forever, he blew us away again when the Hollywood heartthrob first rocked onto the screens as James Whitey Bulger. We had to do a double take. The 70s drama portrays the notorious Irish mobster. He first landed the part. He was going to transform himself. And in the process, it was pretty intense, taking 22 hours. First, the makeup artist covered half his face with prosthetic. Next, they inserted each follicle of the character's thinning hair individually. He completed the look with fake rotting teeth and contacts. Too bad he did all that for a movie that wasn't good. That wasn't good. He's good in it. So, yeah. All right. De Niro, 312 area code says, De Niro reportedly worked 12-hour shifts as a cab driver while preparing for Taxi Driver. A copy of his New York City hack license can be found on Google Images. He did. He actually got his hack license. And he drove around all night. I love that movie so much. It's my favorite Scorsese movie. And, yeah, my dad took me to see it when I was 11. At the Patio Theater. Which, by the way, is getting a facelift.
Yeah, they're going to redo the...
They're going to redo the marquee. Well, they have to redo the marquee. The marquee looks terrible.
Well, I didn't know that so many trucks were hitting it. Yeah. That's why it was getting so banged
up. My parents live right around the corner.
Yeah.
And they, you know, what they did was they shortened the sidewalk. So the marquee, when they widened the street, they widened Irving Park Road, so the marquee went out over the sidewalk. So trucks would smash into it. That's one of the reasons why there's so much damage. It's a beautiful theater. I used to go there all the time. I saw a Taxi Driver there. I saw Mad Max there. First time I ever saw Mad Max was at the Patio. Steve says, what about Matthew McConaughey and Dallas Buyers Club? And Jordan Leto.
Both of them.
And they both won Oscars, deservedly so. Val Kilmer and the Jim Morrison thing was pretentious and bad. That's from Steve, yeah. The movie sucked, too. 815 area could have said, somebody already said the machinist, so I'll have to go with Benicio Del Toro's weight gain for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I think it was like 45 pounds. Yeah, he did gain a ton of weight for that movie. That was the best movie that they could make of what is essentially an unfilmable book. I happen to be a ridiculous Hunter S. Thompson fan, and I think Gilliam made the best movie that he could. Because I remember when they were like, yeah, they're going to make... Because there were rumors about them making that into a movie for many, many, many years. I thought the performances were great. It was a mess because it is... If you've read the book, you read the book and you go, well, you can't... Like I was saying yesterday, Naked Lunch is another example. And why the movie version worked is because Cronenberg made the brilliant decision to make it about writing Naked Lunch. So it had all the Naked Lunch stuff in it, but it was also told from the point of view of Burroughs writing it. And it's brilliant. And man, Roy Scheider. Oh, man, Roy Scheider. 815 Eric Coe says Kirk Lazarus. For those people who don't know, Kirk Lazarus is the name of the actor character that Robert Downey Jr. plays in Tropic Thunder.
I'm the dude playing the dude disguised as another dude.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I still say this, I maintain this, that's not the funniest performance in the movie. Tom Cruise is the funniest performance in that movie. Tom Cruise is hilarious.
Les Grossman.
One of the funniest, I love him, and he's the funniest thing in the movie. He's so great in that movie. The first time I saw it, I mean, obviously that was all makeup effects, but he is transformed in that movie. Just the fat, hairy forearms. I just, you know, they fattened up his hands, and he's got those fat, hairy forearms.
I didn't even know it was him when I first saw it.
All the dancing stuff. I mean, I just. All right. How about Tom Hanks and Castaway? So they filmed all the thin stuff first. So Zemeckis filmed all the thin stuff first, and then they had to wait a bunch of months for him to gain weight. So in the meantime, and this is how much I love Robert Zemeckis, in the meantime, so he's on break. They're on break now for months. They filmed all the thin Tom Hanks stuff first. Got that out of the way. And then Zemeckis is like, yeah, you know, while we're waiting, I'll just screw around and make a movie. And he made What Lies Beneath, which is a fantastic movie. and it was just on a lark. It was just like Zemeckis screwing around, and he made a great movie. What Lies Beneath with Michelle Pfeiffer's and Harrison Ford's. And then, like, you know, so then that was released, like, that was released then he in the same year as as Castaway. So, and Castaway, phenomenal movie. Tom Hanks is great in that movie. It's a great performance. Hugh Grant and Cloud Atlas.
Ooh.
Which I like that movie.
Okay.
Listen, I don't know what it is. I like everything the Wachowskis have done. I even liked Jupiter Ascending.
Where Channing Tatum is a dog man?
Yeah. I even liked that. I like that. I like Speed Racer. I don't care. I like Speed Racer. I think Speed Racer's terrific.
Speed Racer is underrated, but...
And I love Cloud Atlas. I love the stuff that they did in Cloud... They didn't direct... Tyke Ware directed a few segments in that as well. And I love that movie. Yeah, but you can't even recognize Hugh Grant in that. Oscar Isaac in X-Men Apocalypse. Well, that was just like... Wasn't that CGI or was he...
X-Men Apocalypse?
Yeah.
No, that was makeup.
That was makeup?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was CGI. I don't even remember. I just remember the movie wasn't good. That's the thing I remember most about it. Charlize Theron and Monster, which we already mentioned. 50 Cent in Things Fall Apart. I don't even remember this.
I remember them reporting on how much weight he lost.
When hip-hop mogul 50 Cent, or 50 Cent... transition to the silver screen in the movie Things Fall Apart, he went to the next level of extreme. He was so passionate for the role that he dropped 54 pounds. He plays a football player who falls sick, and he lost so much weight he switched to a liquid diet, and he spent 3 hours per day on a treadmill. Fans were surprised to see the former heavyweight look so frail on the screen at 160 pounds. He removed his arm tattoos to save... all the time in the makeup. He removed his arm tattoos? What?
He really went for it.
Wow. No, that's crazy. Now, I know people gain and lose weight from movies all the time, but to actually remove your tattoos? That had to be painful, right?
Expensive.
And expensive, because wasn't he covered in tattoos?
He had a lot, if I remember correctly. He had quite a few.
Wow. Zoe Saldana for Avatar. Now, wait a minute. Wasn't that just... That was CGI, right?
Yeah. I don't know if that one counts.
No. Nothing in Avatar counts. Only movie I've ever seen that was written by a bunch of drunk monkeys. Not even sober monkeys. Drunk monkeys wrote that movie. One of the stupidest movies I've ever seen in my life. Hey, there are like five more coming out. I've been waiting. I don't know about you, but I've been waiting with bated breath for 10 years. God. For a new Avatar movie.
Yeah, I need that like a hole in
oh,
the head.
Man. That movie sucked.
Yeah, I really didn't like it.
I mean, it sucked. All right. Well, let's break here for some weather, and then we'll come back, and we're talking more insane transformations that actors and actresses went through for their roles.
A long, long time ago, on graduation day, you handed me your book. I signed this way, roses are red, my love.
Yeah.
Violets are blue.
Bobby Vinton, everybody. On Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, me Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Welcome back. On this Thursday morning, Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Skyline studio until 5 a.m. We are talking about actors and actresses who made insane transformations for a role. 219 area code says, hey, great topic. How about Farrah Fawcett in the made-for-TV movie Extremities? I was never a fan of hers until that movie. She transformed from a bombshell to a real woman, and you could relate to her character. Extremities was... not a TV movie. The TV movie that she did was Burning Bed. Extremities was a theatrical movie. that's where she takes the would-be rapist and hides in, and jams him into the fireplace. And James Russo plays the with the would-be rapist.
It's intense.
Yeah. Based on a play. And she did the stage version of it. They made a movie out of it. But the you were thinking the TV movie is The Burning Bed, where she sets the bed on fire because her husband is I think Paul LaMatt. Paul LaMatt from American Graffiti. And of course, Melvin and Howard, one of the greatest movies ever made, was the abuser in that movie. And then she set the bed on fire based on a true story. So Extremities was theatrical, but Burning Bed was made for TV. And in both of those movies, she did strip down the, you know, the whole bombshell, you know, Farrah Fawcett hair, beauty kind of a look. Hey, Nick, Trucker Ernie here. Transformations for Old. How about Demi Moore shaving her head and getting buff for G.I. Jane? She got plastic surgery for striptease. Did she get it specifically for striptease? Early on, pregnant for Seventh Sign. Seventh Sign is really one of the stupidest movies ever made. You ever see The Seventh Sign?
I haven't seen it. No.
It's an Apocalypto movie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And normally I like Apocalypto is an actual movie. That's a Mel Gibson movie, I love that movie, Apocalypto. 815 area code says, how about Anthony Michael Hall in the movie Johnny Be Good? Johnny Be Good. You ever see Johnny Be Good?
No. What's...
Yeah, Johnny Be Good. Well, he played like a high school football star, like a badass quarterback. So, but he got buffed up a little bit for it. This was in the 80s. This is like right after the succession of John Hughes movies that he did.
Yeah.
So he thought he could do no wrong. And Robert Downey Jr. is in it, too. And Paul Gleason from Breakfast Club is also in it. And he's being courted by a bunch of colleges to get a football scholarship. So it's about him going from college to college, you know, trying to figure out. It was Uma Thurman's first movie.
Really?
Yeah. She plays this love interest in it. It's also John Hawks is in it as a pizza delivery boy. And it's one of those deals where like it's he's in one scene and it's one of the worst scenes ever. And it's John Hawks, you know, like pre-goatee. Like he's very young in it and he plays a pizza delivery guy and he gets like pepperoni all over his face, like they slam a pizza into his face and they show this clip from time to time to embarrass John Hawks. Now that he's, you know, like a really adored and amazingly talented actor, they show the clip from Johnny B. Goode whenever. It is an unbelievably terrible movie. But you know what movie is even worse? That Anthony Michael Hall directed? Hail Caesar.
Not to be confused with the...
with the terrible Coen Brothers movie. That's another movie I don't like, is Hail Caesar. Best thing in that movie was the scene where Ralph Fiennes is given direction, where Ralph Fiennes is given the line reading to... who is the dude?
Channing Tatum?
Yeah. No.
Not Channing Tatum?
No. The other guy. The guy who played the cowboy in it. He was the lead in the movie that Ralph Fiennes was directing, and he was giving him... I can't remember the guy's name. But it was the only scene in that movie that I laughed my ass off during that scene. The rest of the movie I could not stand.
Was it Alden Ehrenreich?
Yeah.
The guy who plays Han Solo.
Yeah, the guy who plays Han Solo in Solo. Right, that guy. Anyway, when Ralph Fiennes is giving him... do you remember the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He's giving him the line... I can't remember what the line is. He's giving him the line... And that's the only thing I laughed at the entire... I thought that movie was terrible. But anyway, Hail Caesar... with the better one, which is directed by Anthony Michael Hall, and it is ridiculous. And Robert Downey Jr. is in one scene in it. This is when Robert Downey Jr. This came out pretty late, so I think Robert Downey Jr. was in the middle of getting himself clean. So he's only in one scene. But in Johnny B. Good, I believe there was a lot of substance abuse going on in that movie. But yeah. How about Chris Pratt in Guardians of the Galaxy?
Oh yeah,
I like my Chris Pratt. Like I said before, I like him pudgy and goofy.
Yeah,
and
well.
I like him pudgy, goofy, and dumb. Basically, I like Andy. That's when I think of how much I love Chris Pratt. It's always Andy.
You know, what's her name? Who was he married to again previously?
Anna Faris?
Anna Faris.
Yeah.
I saw she released a memoir or like a book, and the foreword is by Chris Pratt.
Oh, no, they're still...
Are they good?
Yeah, he just got married.
Yeah, he married.
She went to the wedding.
Really?
Yeah. No, they're good. They're on really good. They're fine.
Oh, that's good.
And they also, because I think they have kids together, too. So mm-hmm. they're remaining friendly.
That's good.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was sad to see that. I was sad to see them break up because I love both of them.
Well, now he's married to Arnold Schwarzenegger's
daughter. Arnold Schwarzenegger's daughter.
Jeez.
But I was sad to see them break up because I like them both so much because they're both so funny and likable.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was also sad when because I like it when two really talented and funny people get together because I'm like, oh, well, they're going to have their offspring is going to be hilarious and awesome. And I felt that way about Anna Faris and Chris Pratt. I don't know the people, but that's just the public, you know, my perception of them. But I was very upset when Will Arnett and Amy Poehler broke up. Very upset because they're, you know. All right. Every time I think of Will Arnett, I think of the Final Countdown. Because every time Job did one of his magic tricks, he did it to Final Countdown.
They're not tricks, Michael. They're illusions. <It's> the <best. laughs>
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, but they never hear me. The breeze hasn't time.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200. We're going to get back into the incredibly weird and crazy extreme transformations that actors and actresses underwent in order to play a role, like losing a bunch of weight or getting some sort of physical trait changed or anything like that. 312-981-7200. Triple Play Thursday. You've been Triple Play Thursday. What was that? Who was that?
So that was requested by John in Decatur. It's Clint Eastwood.
Ah.
I Talk to the Trees.
Okay.
I did not know he had a singing career.
Have you not seen Paint Your Wagon?
Mom's favorite movie.
Seriously?
Totally. Her favorite movie. And it's so weird because my mom and dad used to watch that with us kids. And now as an adult, it's like, that was a little risque.
Wait a second. That's your mom's favorite movie is Paint Your Wagon?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Wow.
Second is, it's like a 4-hour movie. Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind. Yeah. Oh. Wow. But Paint Your Wagon.
Tom, you got to watch Paint Your Wagon.
I still
like it.
Yeah, you get to hear Clint Eastwood sing, Lee Marvin sings.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a musical. Clint Eastwood, Lee Marvin musical.
Lee Marvin.
A Western
musical.
Lee Marvin's good in it, I think. Lee Marvin was good in everything.
Right.
Lee Marvin was the best, man. Yeah, wow, that's so weird. Your mom's favorite movie is Paint Your Wagon. That's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy. No, Clint sang, as you heard. He sang to the trees, and they didn't listen. Paint Your Wagon. You've not
so
seen
we
Paint
shot
Your
the
Wagon.
Tree.
That's he shot the tree. That's right. You feel lucky, tree? Well, do you, punk?
Get out of town.
Yeah.
Go ahead, make my day.
Man, you remember back in 1983 when that was everywhere?
Did you know that when he was running for mayor of Carlsbad, California, he used that character? He kind of summoned that character for some of his ad campaigns.
For Dirty Harry?
Yes, when he used to say, make my day.
Yeah, it was Carmel.
Carmel, yeah, yeah. Not Carlsbad. Yeah,
because
he was mayor.
He was mayor of Carmel.
Difference.
Yeah.
Yep,
so
right, yep.
He went around acting like Dirty Harry.
No, but there was an ad that that said
vote for me, go ahead, make my day or something like that.
No, he was talking about kind of a criminal element there, and he said, the way I see it, they can either clean up their act or get out of town.
Wait a minute. What criminal element in Carmel?
I know, right?
There is zero criminal element in Carmel. What are you kidding?
I think
violence in the streets. I think Carmel, then Detroit. Carmel always pops up first when I think about gang activities and violence.
Right.
Carmel has a crime element.
Roving gangs of middle class
financial.
Not even middle class, man. Are you kidding me? The crime in Carmel would be I sent back a bottle of wine because I didn't like it. That's the crime. That's the crime element in Carmel. So, somebody got a little lippy with a waitress over a glass of wine. That's the crime element that Clint Eastwood had to take care of in Carmel.
The only crime in Carmel is if you didn't double your money on a real estate investment.
That's exactly right. Yeah, he was mayor for a while in Carmel. That was in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clint. You gotta love Clint. Gotta love Clint, man. You know what else you gotta love? Is you gotta love Bill Hader's imitation of Clint, where he hikes his pants up to his nipples. Do you remember speaking of Detroit, he did a series of commercials during a Super Bowl probably about 10 years ago or 8 or 9 years ago. I can't remember what company it was for, but it was all about, we got to get America back on track. And it was all about manufacturing cars, building cars here in America. And it was a series of commercials that ran during the Super Bowl. And there were about four or five of them, and they were, you know, I mean, every year during the Super Bowl, everybody talks about the commercials, and that was one of the most talked about series of commercials, with Clint Eastwood doing the car commercial.
It's halftime in America.
There
too.
We go.
People are out of work and they're hurting, and they're all wondering what they're going to do to make a comeback, and we're all scared because this isn't a game. The people of Detroit know a little something about this. They almost lost everything. But we all pull together. Now Motor City is fighting again.
Yeah. I've seen. So that's it. So they did a parody of that on SNL a couple of weeks after that Super Bowl. And Hader was doing Clint. You know, it's halftime in your life. And it's Bill Hader doing. Oh, you got it?
During the Super Bowl, I said it was halftime for America. I said Motor City's getting back on its feet. I tried to make an inspiring ad that would rally our country. But you dummies in the media thought it was about politics. Well, guess what? Halftime's over. We're in the third quarter now, America, and we're way behind. So I don't care if Obama runs the ball.
What you're basically missing is the visual, because they did about four parodies, you know, like in the Super Bowl, there were four different commercials. And then so SNL did that with each successive commercial, Bill Hader's pants were hiked up even more. Like each funny. Commercial, it was his pants were hiked up until the last commercial, they were at his neck. They were like his pants were up at his neck.
I have to commend you on your impersonation, because there was virtually no difference between what you were doing and when he played the audio.
Clint is, you know, I mean, you just got to go like this. That's all you got to do.
Get away from my Gran Torino.
That's right.
Get off my lawn.
Gran Torino.
Just don't bore me.
Yeah.
Get me a beer.
Just, he was like in the Mule.
Yeah, give me the kilo. I'll drive it.
You know,
but that didn't scare little Bill, did it?
Clint. Well, now we get to hear him sing again. We don't get to hear it. It's not going to be a threefer, though.
It won't be a triple, but
no triple play. No triple play. I'm assuming the next one's got to be a song from. It's got to be a song from Paint Your Wagon. Did he? Unless Clint released an album. Oh, he did. No. Clint did release an album, and he sang on. Did you ever see the movie Honky Tonk Man?
No.
Great movie. You know why it's great? Because Clint directed it. But no, he sang on. He sang on Honky Tonk Man. He also sang Gran Torino. He sang the song for Gran Torino.
I'm driving a Gran Torino.
I can't remember the lyrics, but he sang on Gran Torino. He sang a lot. He's done singing a lot. Yeah. So, all right. Well, we'll hear. Now we're talking about transformations from actors. They have Matthew McConaughey here for the movie Gold.
Did that get released?
Yes, it did.
Did anyone see it?
I did.
I did too. I watched it. I can't remember where I came across that, but I did watch that.
I watched it.
I remember seeing the trailer. I just felt like it was in and out of theaters.
That was his third movie with Kate Hudson? Because he was in one of those. Was it How to Lose a Guy? No. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days? Or How to what?
Honolulu?
Because it's a failure to launch that was Sarah Jessica Parker. How to Lose a Guy. I think How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days was Kate Hudson. And Gold was Kate Hudson as well. That was when he was doing those rom-coms before, you know.
Yeah, Fool's Gold. Yeah.
Yeah.
So How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Fool's Gold, and then just Gold.
No. Gold is Gold is different.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Gold is different. Gold is the one where he gained a bunch of weight and he thinned his hair. Yeah.
Did you not?
Yeah. I was thinking it was.
You were thinking
it was
of Fool's Gold.
I thought it was Fool's Gold. I was thinking Fool's Gold.
No, Fool's Gold is a romantic comedy.
Yeah, that's what I got confused about it. Gold's not a very good movie.
See, no. When you said rom-com, I knew I hadn't seen that. That's not exactly my favorite genre.
Yeah. No, this is based on the true story where they strike gold.
Yeah.
And,
see, I saw the trailers for all that stuff, and
it was gone.
Sudden,
it was only out
a week.
Malaria.
It was out. It was only out. It was out for about a week.
And it was that bad.
No,
I liked it.
He's good in it. He's really good in
sure.
it.
Sure.
I mean, but I personally think that that's the true of McConaughey and everything. Even if the movie's bad, he's good in it. I think that even in the rom-coms he did, I thought he was good in them. Some of them really, really terrible, like The Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. He did like four in a row, man. There was like four or five in a row there in the early 2000s that he did where it was like, what are you doing?
I grew up hating McConaughey.
Yeah,
because I hadn't seen Dazed and Confused until I was probably late high school, and then I was like, oh no, wait, this guy's super cool.
He's the best, man.
And then Amistad.
Amistad.
Damn right, this ain't Amistad.
Contact, too.
Contact,
yeah. Zemeckis. But yeah, man.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Say, man, you got a joint? Here we
go. Say, man, you got a joint?
No, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
Be a lot cooler if you did. They got a t-shirt. I have, well, as you know, I have four different all right t-shirts.
It's true.
And there's also a t-shirt that just says, I've seen Matthew McConaughey wear it, actually. There's a t-shirt that just says, it'd be a lot cooler if you did.
Could use that in a variety of contexts.
Oh, man.
Hey, did you vote this year? Nah, man, I didn't register. It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
Vote for me, man. Dave Wooderson for Senate. Everybody in the 70s knew a Dave Wooderson, man. Everybody in the 70s knew a Dave Wooderson. It's one of the reasons.
Isn't it based off his brother, Rooster? Kind of?
No, not really. The character itself is based on a friend of Linklater's that he knew back in the day. But as far as performance goes, McConaughey did sort of ape his brother Rooster. I got my brother named Rooster. He talks about Rooster. And he talks about how my mother would never call me Matt. Anybody calls me Matt, it's a biblical name. It's Matthew, not Matt. My mom would slap me silly if I referred to myself as Matt. Speaking of Matts, you ever see Matt Damon do his impression of Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's good stuff. It's quality stuff.
It is fantastic. Every time he was on Letterman, Letterman would make him do it. Even if there were, like, Letterman would always make Matt Damon do his Matthew McConaughey imitation, and it was always the same. He'd be like, say, Dave. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I think this would be a good opportunity for us to take our shirts off. You got to look it up. It's on YouTube. There's a compilation of Matt Damon doing Matthew McConaughey, and there's also a great one where they show Matthew McConaughey, Matt Damon doing the imitation. Matthew McConaughey's, man, that's good. That's real good.
Hey, I want to sing till the feeling gets right.
Well, let's harmonize. We'll be dynamite.
I yodel the high notes. I've done it for years.
Good deal, old buddy, and I'll pour the beers.
There's always some lady alone at the bar.
Yeah, and you always let her know just who you are.
I know a couple gals that we can call. Damn, they'll shake the picture right
that's
off
right.
the wall. We're barroom buddies, and that's the
That's from any Every Which Way But Loose, if I'm not mistaken. Or
Bronco Billy.
Bronco
Billy.
Oh, yeah, Bronco. God, that's a good movie.
Merle Haggard.
Yeah, Merle Haggard and Clint. Man, Bronco Billy is a good movie. Clint Eastwood's made a lot of good movies. And he's directed a lot of good movies, too. He's nuts now, but he's made a lot of great movies.
Well, I feel like the turning point was when he had a fake conversation
with a chair. Yeah, at the Republican convention. I was like, what are you doing, Clint? What's happening? But you know what? His last movie was really good. The Mule was really good. He's like 106, and he's directing movies like every week. He directs at least a movie a year, and he's like 86, 87 years old.
It's wild.
Crazy. You know which movie was really, really good that he directed, besides most of them? And the best performance Angelina Jolie has ever given. You ever see Changeling?
Yeah.
She's great in that movie.
She's very good. Very, very good.
That came out the same year as Gran Torino. Like, he directed that one, and then, I'm not kidding, and Gran Torino came out, get off my lawn. All right. Hey, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we're talking about startling transformations from actors and actresses. How about Ben Kingsley in Gandhi? Lost a ton of weight. And, he won the Academy Award for that. Jake Gyllenhaal in Southpaw. We played the boxer.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. He got cut.
He was cut. And you know what is really strange? If you watch that back-to-back with Nightcrawler, because he lost a bunch of weight for Nightcrawler is such a good movie. And he's great in it. How about this? Tilda Swinton in Suspiria.
That's excellent choice.
There's the thing, you know, people are, you know, like Eric, you know, is like, why, because he didn't like Suspiria. He didn't like the remake. But like, why would what's with the stunt casting where she plays the old man in it? And I'm like, I don't care about that. It's cool.
I don't think it's stunt casting.
I think she's great.
I would not call that stunt casting.
She plays three roles in Suspiria, by the way.
Who's the third one?
She's the demon at the end of the movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
She plays the mother. She plays the Mother of Tears at the end of the movie.
Yeah, Mother Suspiria.
Yeah. Christian Bale in American Hustle. We mentioned that one already. We got all fat. I love that movie. So much, American Hustle. I mean, I just love it. Everybody is so good in that movie.
It's my favorite Jennifer Lawrence performance.
Well, I mean, you're not a big fan. I'm a huge fan of Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's great. She's hilarious in American Hustle. Hilarious.
That science oven.
The science oven, fantastic. She's got a neck brace on at one point.
What was the one she made after that? Joy.
Great movie. It's David O. Russell. I love Joy. I thought it was great. But no, I think Jennifer Lawrence is great. I've loved her since Winter's Bone. I mean, I thought she was great. Glenn Close in Hook, barely recognizable. She plays a pirate.
Smee?
I don't know if she's Smee.
That's so weird.
She's not Smee, but you can't even recognize her. She's got a beard and all that stuff.
We're gonna put Glenn Close. Take Glenn Close, super beautiful, turn her into a pirate.
Yeah, man, they did it. Ewan McGregor in Fargo.
Yeah.
Because they had to differentiate between the two. We mentioned Robert De Niro on Raging Bull. Meryl Streep in The Iron Lady, she won the Oscar for that, did not deserve it.
I think that is, the Iron Lady is one of the most one-sided portrayals of a politician I've ever seen.
It's not a good movie. I mean,
it's not good, no, and she's it, completely, not great. It completely ignores so much.
Yeah. Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah.
Well, also Hilary Swank in Speaking of Clint, Million Dollar Baby. She got buff for that.
Mm-hmm. I still can't sit well with the whole stool thing. The rest of that movie is great, I think, but the stool thing is just absurd.
I don't know. No, I love that movie.
I think overall it's great, but the stool thing,
J.K. Simmons in Justice League.
He got buff.
Yeah. Well, he was pretty buff even in Whiplash when he's.
Oh yeah,
you know,
he's never out of shape.
Yeah.
But he like was in the gym.
Yeah.
Lifting, like going crazy.
God, Whiplash! What a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not quite my tempo.
Oh God, I love that movie. I love that movie. So good. Jared Leto in Chapter 27.
Yeah, gained a ton of weight to be Mark David Chapman.
Yeah, jerk. Taron Egerton for Rocket Man. What did he do?
Well, he had the gap and added the gap to his teeth.
Oh, he had the gap to his tooth, yeah.
Yeah, he did quite a bit of hair. He had the receding hairline.
He's great in it.
He's good.
He's great in it. Jared Leto in Suicide Squad. What a jackass he was in that. And his antics on set, too.
Yeah. Stupid.
Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder is mentioned.
You gotta have Les Grossman. Smack that ass, Les.
Steve Carell in Foxcatcher. That's a good one. He looked completely different. Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour.
Gary Oldman in True Romance, man.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy in Coming to America. Come on, Cletus! Come on, Cletus! Bring it, Cletus! That scene around the dinner table... I'm telling you, the first time I saw The Nutty Professor, and I was ready to hate it because why would anybody remake Jerry Lewis's masterpiece? Mm-hmm. But Jerry Lewis approved, and it's very funny. It's terrific. But that scene where it's just him, except for little Hercules, that whole scene is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. One of the hardest times I've ever laughed in a movie theater was, and I had to go back and see it a second time because the audience was laughing so hard we couldn't hear some of the jokes that were coming up. Seriously, one of the funniest scenes in movie history, I think. And Eddie Murphy, I think, deserved an Academy Award nomination for that movie, for the amount of different characters that he played.
Are you a fan of Norbit?
No, I'm not a fan of Norbit.
I'm just checking.
No.
I'm just checking.
No. No, not a fan of Norbit. Or the where you get shrunk down in the... Rosario Dawson in there inside the robot or something, and he's a I don't even remember what the hell it's called, but it was
who knows.
All right, we got a break here, and we're going to come back, and the news is up next, and then tomorrow Esmeralda Leon is going to be here. She's fantastic, and she'll be here.